Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Is that the door?
Oh, don't worry, it's just the actors.
My Uncle Baldrick was in a play once.
Really?
Yeah, it was called Macbeth.
Actors are very superstitious. On no account mention the word Macbeth this evening, all right?
Why not?
It brings them bad luck and it makes them very unhappy.
Oh, so you won't be mentioning it either?
No. Well, not very often. You should have knocked.
Oh, knocked, you impertinent butler. We're loud enough to wake the hounds of hell. Lead on, Macbeth.
I shall.
Lest you continue in your quotation and mention the name of the Scottish play.
No, never fear, I shan't do that.
By the Scottish play, I assume you mean Macbeth.
Potato, all the stores, but we may commence.
What was that?
You were exorcising evil spirits. Being but a mere butler, you will not know the great theatre tradition that one does never speak the name of the Scottish play.
What, Macbeth?
Ah! Hot potato, officer's horse, but we make amends.
Ah! Oh, you mean you have to do that every time I say Macbeth?
Ah! Hot potato, officer's horse, but we make amends. Ah! Will you please stop saying that? Always call it the Scottish play.
So you want me to say the Scottish play?
Yes!
Rather than Macbeth.
Hot potato, officer's horse, pack will make amends.
Say, what is all this hullabaloo? All this shouting and screaming and yelling blue murder? Why, it's like that play we saw the other day. What was it called?
Macbeth, sir?
Hot potato, officer's horse, pack will make amends.
No. It was called Julius Caesar.
Oh, yes, of course. Julius Caesar. Not Macbeth.
After the hour of one, in this, the month of January, in the year of our Lord, 2011, thank you for coming by, making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed, yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, America's new home for quality and family entertainment. Thank you for joining us. It is Tuesday, January 25th, 2011. And welcome to Day 12. It's 503-505-6964 if you want, you should be part of the program today. Get in on the action. Get on board. It's 503-505-6964 with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature. With all of these, can you interact and engage with us, your hosts? It is 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick at rickemerson.com. That is rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be emailed. That is Don, D-A-W-N, Don at rickemerson.com. Text box open on the website. And, of course, you can also message us via Skype if you like. That is Rick Emerson Show at Skype. That is that's how you engage with us there. That is Rick Emerson Show. Before we do anything else, I should say that coming up this hour, we got your, in this show anyway, it may or may not fall within this hour. Almost nothing that I telegraph or promote as being in this hour actually falls. It's almost like it's a reflexive reaction of the universe, as though I can make things happen later just by saying they're going to happen now. I wonder if I were to say that something was happening toward the end of the program, if it would somehow have to happen before 2 o'clock.
I have no idea. Maybe you should try.
I will also say that Well, I'm getting myself all boondoggled there. Coming up today, we got your Cheney Watch, Taser Watch, Joy of Christmas, and I swear to God, this isn't a rerun. It is, depending on when you're listening to it, it is January 25th, 2011. And the other thing is, I don't know how it's a Joy of Christmas. Like, I don't know anything about the story. I don't know the headline. I don't know any of the facts. I don't know any of the details. It is a complete and total mystery to me. But you were all sort of all a bustle and a flutter with excitement. You said, I've got a new Joy of Christmas here in late January. Yeah. So we got your Joy of Christmas coming up today.
I sounded just like Dr. Farnsworth. as I do.
Oh, my, yes. Cheney Watch, Taser Watch, Joy of Christmas. Today's top five. Today we have your top five. Could you possibly imagine what today's top five is, Don Taylor?
Top five ways in which I have failed you.
Well, no, that wouldn't be.
You wouldn't have songs for that.
I wouldn't have time enough for that, Don.
Where to begin?
No, today we have the top five posthumous albums of all time.
It's
the top five albums released after the death of the performer. Yeah, top five posthumous albums, which is difficult, by the way. It was not easy what I do over here. So today I got your top five posthumous albums of all time. We'll talk to Mr. Eric D. Snyder, who is live at the Sundance Film Festival. That'll be coming up about an hour from now. Let's see. What else? This just happened to me just seconds before we came on the air here. I saw this email, and you actually don't know what it says. I didn't reveal the content of the email to you. I just said, we were talking about Academy Award-winning actress Monique, and you were looking up. Were you looking? Was it a review that you had written?
Yes.
Of Welcome Home, Leroy Jenkins, or whatever.
Roscoe Jenkins.
Sorry.
Because I wanted to see if my memory of how much I hated that movie was as extreme as it really was, and I went and found it and said yes. Apparently, it would seem I hated that movie even more at the time than I remember.
We should say the last hour. So during Legion of News, we had a whole segment on the Academy Awards. I might play the sound bites again this hour just to sort of keep the hate fresh, just to stoke the fires of hate. And they were the list, at least some of the nominees. I think nominees for Best Picture, nominees for Best Actor. They were being read by Academy Award winner. It's like you can't help yourself. It's like how when you sneeze, you have to close your eyes, because otherwise, I think they would blow out the front of your face. It's like when I say Academy Award nominated actor money, you just. It's not like a clenching of the teeth. It's like when your retarded kid does something in front of your friends, like your boss, and even though you've sort of warned them and they know the deal, they just sort of shake their head anyway, and you just kind of go like, the things I would do over again. It's like a low-grade pain. Like, it doesn't cause you anguish. It's just like a nagging sort of toothache. Like, you don't have to go to the dentist right away about it, but it makes it difficult to eat pecans. That's sort of what it is.
Yeah, I think, in retrospect, we all find it sort of hilarious that Cuba Gooding Jr. is an Academy Award winner. But he hadn't really done a lot before he won, and then he made crap afterwards. Monique made crap first. She made Beer Fest. She made Welcome Home, Roscoe Jenkins. She was on that TV show where she was apparently trying to, like, teach manners to the Flavor of Love girls. I mean, and she is one of the most gratingly obnoxious and unfunny, quote, comedians ever to hit show business.
I forgot that she was a stand-up comic. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah. And then she actually, and I'll say, Precious, not as terrible a movie as I feared it would be.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I actually thought it was very well done. And I'll admit, she was good in it. But she's so horrible.
She is
so horrible.
Is this like the, I was going to say, is it like the Kevin Costner thing? But Kevin Costner hadn't really made, he just started making crap after the Academy Award.
Same with Ben Affleck.
Yeah.
I mean, we say Academy Award winner, Ben Affleck, and we all laugh. But the thing is, they made crap afterwards. She made crap first. And there's just this thing of like, really? We're going to reward her now for not sucking in something after so much suck?
And having not seen Precious, I told you about my attempts, my sort of struggling through the book, which is written in this phonetically rendered fragmented speech. It's like this weird incesty version of Sometimes a Great Notion, where there's just like multiple points of view and it changes speakers sometimes in the middle of a paragraph and there's no sort of line break. So it's like this this weird E.E. Cummings, like, crossed with total illiteracy. And I remember just struggling through it, just going, like, I can't read any more of this. It's smoothing out my brain. So I did not see the film. But it, is this one of those things, like, Spy Magazine years ago did this chart about like, the... Like the number of physical and or mental defects or diseases that your character had as relates to your chances of getting an Oscar, and it was like a direct proportion. It was sort of like the Rain Man syndrome.
Yeah.
It's like the more gimped up you are, you know, as a character, the greater the likelihood that they're going to give you the gold statue.
Well, this was I think Mariah Carey was really hoping she'd get some appreciation because she did the whole kind of Charlize Theron in Monster thing where she dared to go on screen without any makeup on and with like a little fake mustache drawn in. And she was the plain but caring social
worker.
She was the
social worker.
Yeah, and Monique was the horrible, like, you know, crack addict, abusive mom in the bathrobe who'd sit there and say, "Boil me up more pig's feet," and throw things at Precious, and was just, and there was that scene where she's at the top of the TV, and she actually heaves a TV at her, and the thing is, it's just like, honest to God, if you ever have had to see a movie, and I will once again go back to the Welcome Home, Roscoe Jenkins, because as I told you in between the shows, it's partially responsible for me leaving film criticism.
It broke you.
I think it broke me. There's a point when you can only be forced to see so many Adam Sandler movies and what have you, but it was so awful. It was so aggressively awful. The kind of awful that you're sitting there and you can't leave because you're working, and you just hate every single person in this movie. And it stars Martin Lawrence, and I hate Martin Lawrence. And the thing is, he has to go visit his family, and every member of his family is obnoxious and horrible. And Monique is the worst of them all. And there's actually a scene in the movie where they end up in a fist fight. She plays his sister. And it's a toss-up as to which one you would rather see beaten to a bloody pulp. It's supposed to be funny, and I just wanted to see them both injured and harmed. I honest to God, it's the kind of movie that if I had walked out of that theater and Monique had been standing there when I walked out of the theater, I would have punched her in the face.
And it would have been worth whatever the penalty was.
It would have been.
It would have been deeply satisfying, and you would have gone to jail with a smile on your face.
I would have gone to court, and I would have said to the judge, "Have you seen Welcome Home, Roscoe?" Well, until you have, you really are not allowed to pass judgment on this. And then the judge would go watch the movie, and they'd come back, and they'd say, "Okay, you can go."
I'm just doing picturing that thing where they sequester the jury, and they're in the screening room, and it's like, you know, it's flickering to the back, and the jury, and they're just heaving into bags, you know, into yeah, air sickness containers.
And then the jury comes back, and they have to hold all of them back so that they don't punch Monique.
Awesome. All right. At some point, that time is not now, but at some time during the show, I may read all of these pro Welcome Home Roscoe Jenkins messages that are popping up. I fear to do that now is going to trigger some sort of nuclear incident, so we're just going to... Why were we talking about this?
The Oscar nominations, and Monique read some of the
Academy Award winner, Monique.
I know.
Get it straight, Don. So we'll get to that soundbite later on, just because there's other stuff to talk about with that. So,
by the way, you know who played Martin Lawrence's father in Welcome Home, Roscoe?
Was it Martin Lawrence in a wig?
No, it was James. I can't even say it. No, move on.
No,
it
you have to tell me. Who played Martin Lawrence? This is in Welcome, which I have not
this is
seen,
the thing,
by
you
the
you know
way.
What the thing is? I was about to say it, and I actually had, like, a stroke.
Did your brain actually flush the information out of your head?
It was James Earl Jones.
Really?
Yeah, and Margaret Avery played his mother.
Did you just hang your head? And just
I believe in the review I said that it's worth noting simply because it points out just how few roles there are for black actors of this caliber. That you can't imagine that they could have read the script and not taken any other movie, like a sequel to Snow Dogs or a remake of The Jeffersons directed by Uwe Boll, anything other than make this movie. But they were like, nope, this is the only work there is.
And as the heroin-addicted drag queen, Ossie Davis.
God. James Earl Jones was in that movie.
Is that like one of those things where you're watching like the ninth Fockers movie and it's like Robert De Niro is doing something on screen involving poop and you're just going like, and you just like want to weep for humanity?
Yes, exactly.
Into your head, just why Robert De Niro? All right. Oh. Well, in any event, so today, Cheney Watch, Taser Watch. Believe me, it's not going to be all just Roscoe Jenkins today, and misplaced apostrophes. It'll be largely that, but not all that. Cheney Watch, Taser Watch, Joy of Christmas, top five posthumous albums of all time. Mr. Eric D. Snyder will be calling in from the Sundance Film Festival. Maybe Monique will be starring in some exciting new film there that he can tell you all about.
Maybe.
You can buy advance tickets for it now. Let's see. We got a clue number two coming up in this week's EH Vending Contest. You can find out more about EH Vending by going to ehvending.com. That is ehvending.com, providing vending services for your business or quite possibly just for, you know, like the space next to your bed if you don't feel like, you know, fully waking up in the morning before you have some Cheetos. ehvending.com. We'll get the clue number two today, ehvending.com, sponsors of that contest. Let's see what else. Oh, and I got this fantastic email to read. In just a sec. I don't even know if I should give anything... I don't even know if I should give anything away about this. I don't think I will. I will say that Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this Tuesday.
Well, there are the Oscar nominations and the Razzie nominations, which were announced today. A lawsuit targets Taco Bell's quote-unquote meat.
Okay.
And a semi overturns and dumps pigs all over the road.
Okay. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. Let's see, did I have anything from yesterday that we didn't get a chance to talk about at the top of the show before I... And I only say that because I want to be able to crumple up this piece of paper and throw it away. Because yesterday was just such a jam-packed show, and like right out of the gate...
Well, make sure you don't need whatever is written on the back.
No, I've transcribed this somewhere else. Yesterday, I forget exactly what it was that just took us off schedule like immediately yesterday. But yesterday was really a show that was just full of amusement. Let me just read a couple of these observations that I wrote down on a piece of paper yesterday morning, and then we'll move on.
Okay.
Listener Jenny says, this is, I think, about Friday's show. Listener Jenny says, quote... Jesus Christ, what am I doing wrong? My doctor won't give me any meds for anything. I've tried to get drugs for about the past 20 years. I only got 20 Ativan once, and I had to get cancer to get those. Jenny, end quote. Let's see, what else? I watched Portlandia. I was like the last guy. Everybody in the world, I think, had seen it by the time. I don't think anybody actually watched it on IFC because I think they already had. I think I was like the lone guy in the IFC house that night.
Okay.
So I watched Portlandia. Can I just say this? And I know it's Tuesday and, like, I don't know. By now, the city has probably taken some sort of... I don't know. We've all probably taken a vote and we're supposed to, like, not talk about Portlandia anymore. It's probably become one of those things. In fact, I almost know that it has. I sense a great disturbance in the force that I say it.
We'll just pretend it doesn't exist.
But it's like, don't you sense that right now we're at that point where if you go, Portlandia, people go, ugh, God. It's like Lara said that she had reached that point on Friday and she had not yet seen the show. That somebody at work was like, what about Portlandia? And she said that she was just like, stop it. Stop. Just quit with the Portlandia. And she didn't want to hear any more about it. Not because it was going to be spoiled or whatever, but just because she said she was just sick of hearing about it. And it had not yet actually aired. She hadn't seen anything. So I feel like we are at that point, but I got to get my... The thing is, it's so difficult to review that show objectively. And then people are saying, well, you know, it's either funny or sad or either makes you laugh or doesn't. But I think that might be one thing if you live somewhere else. I think if you live in Portland, it is a little tricky because, A, you're constantly distracted by, oh, my God, Steve Buscemi's in my city, you know, and you're just, you know, that's sort of a diversionary tactic they use every now and again, you know, on shows where it's like they'll, you know, they bring on the stunt actor or whatever, and it takes you out of the show for a second. So plus it was just so much... I'm not even hype. It was just one of those things. It was, as we said about some Sundance film yesterday, it was like a polarizing show. And everybody just immediately staked out some really seemingly arbitrary, like, extreme position about Portlandia. I do have to say that I kind of fall down with Anna Griffin on this, in this sort of the solid, kind of a... Because... And it's not like I'm exempt from this or any form of entertainment or anybody that traffics in the field of comedy or, you know, or entertainment or whatever... The thing about Portlandia, not all the time, but a great deal of the time, is Portlandia has that Family Guy thing going on where just mentioning a thing is not the same thing as making funny observations about it, you know, where you just like say something, hey, we all love the Breakfast Club, you know, or whatever. And it seems like Portlandia was doing that a little bit where it's like they would hey, the chicks here wear glasses. And then you kind of go, yes, and... I guess there's no follow-up. And the thing is, I'm not saying that's not amusing, but I think it's only amusing, literally only amusing, if you're here. And I guess that maybe that's okay. I guess there can be some sort of inside references or whatever. I don't know. And I'm going to officially quit thinking about it, like, in 5 minutes, because I don't really care that much. Like, it just seems like it's a disproportionate use of my CPU. But I honestly don't know if it's funny or not. And it seems dumb to say that, but I honestly have people say, well, it's either funny or it's not. Take your personal feelings and the, you know what? Don't let the hype influence you. I don't know whether it's funny. I honestly don't know.
It's like, you know, I said it times. It's the you think to yourself, oh, that's funny. But it's not the laugh out loud funny.
It's
kind
wryly
of funny.
Amusing, I guess, is the thing. I guess that's my thing. Is I kind of went, oh, that's vaguely similar to a situation I encountered in my own experience here in Portland. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
You know. Ooh, Stephen Gould is on NPR. You know, and then I just, you know, whatever. So I just I don't know. I do agree with Seamus as well that I think you're going to get like 3 or 4 episodes into that, and I think it's going to be like, hey, and they all wear shoes, because I don't really know what else there's going to be to mention at that point. So, you know. Anyway, I'm now officially washing my hands pilot style of that.
Okay.
Let's see, what else do we have here? Oh, my God! I actually wrote down here, OMG. OMG, have you seen Cheryl Kanakoa's profile picture on Facebook?
No.
Oh, my God! No, you got to go look at it right now. Okay. It's freaking awesome. I hope that she hasn't changed it, like, in the last 24 hours. It is. It really is. It's fantastic because it's got like multiple layers of greatness going on. First, I think it's from when she was like 7. Secondly, I don't know where she was when it was taken or like where she's standing. But third, the obvious. Okay, are you there?
Oh yeah.
You look at it. Is it the old 70s photo?
Yeah.
There? Yeah. How great. Okay. Do you see what I see?
So that's her in like a.
Say it.
A Cylon?
Yeah. How great is that? That's got to be like Universal Studios or something. I mean, it must be.
Yeah. Wow.
Or maybe Hawaii is just full of Cylons.
Maybe.
Maybe it's something other than just coconuts
There's
and
so many
pine
things
trees
I don't
or whatever.
Know about Hawaii.
I don't know. It's a place of just like here's the thing. When I picture Hawaii, I know it's wrong to do this. Everything in Hawaii is either just that opening shot of Magnum PI with TC's helicopter going, or it's like I just picture the sign from a Bali High hotel. You know, where it's like the guy going, whoa, and he's got like a spike on his head. I don't know. That's all I can picture in Hawaii. That, and again, they all live in huts.
Well, I've been to Hawaii, and it's very humid, which you kind of expect because it's tropical. And the other thing that I noticed from being in Hawaii, because I was in Honolulu, is that I had that experience of like standing on the balcony of my hotel and looking out the window and going, wow, it looks exactly like it looks in the movies.
This looks like that Hawaii that I saw on TV that one time.
Like, you see something really pretty, and you go, wow, the beach and everything is gorgeous, and then you take a picture of it, and you look at it later, and it just looks like a postcard.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow, and I was actually there. But, of course, this just looks like a postcard I could have bought, so there's nothing personal about this. Yeah, it's freakishly familiar because you've seen it, like, your whole life. And then all of a sudden, it's like they're in front of you, and you're like kind of...
And you can't adjust to it.
It does look exactly like this.
It was sort of like... This is not really to the same degree, but it was sort of like when I, you know, because I never lived anywhere good for the longest time. I just lived in one crap hole after another. I was just like, where am I moving now? Akron. Okay. Hooray. Where am I moving now? Omaha. Okay. You know, I just lived in one horrible city after another. But then the first time I went to... It wasn't even San Diego, because before I went to San Diego, because I spent some time in LA growing up, but it's like LA just sucks. LA is just a horrible U-joint of a, you know, it's like in the sink of humanity. Mm-hmm. It's just a grease trap. I mean, it's just a horrible, grimy place filled with dust and hatred and awful people.
Yeah, there are marvelous things about the Los Angeles area, but the thing is, to get to those marvelous things, you have to put up with 98% of Los Angeles,
yeah.
Which is just strip malls full of donut places
and
discount shoe marts.
And it's just a gritty, dirty feeling place. Mm-hmm. And it's like after you're there for a while, it's like you do start to get a little bit of a sense of like the whole less than zero thing, where it's just like the sun and just the congestion and the people on top of people and the endless miles of pavement and just the everybody looking really beautiful but really ugly at the same time. After a while, it just F's with your brain. But the first place I ever went, you know, outside of Los Angeles in Southern California, was not even San Diego, it was to La Jolla. And I remember, like, stepping out. We went there on the way to San Diego, I guess, somehow. I forget how that worked. But I got out of the car in La Jolla. And it was that thing where I just went, Oh my God! And it was the same thing. Like, because I've never been to Hawaii or anywhere good growing up. You know, it's like we would go to Seattle. Like that was our big, like exotic vacation. It was like I would feed seagulls. You know, at Ivor's Fish Bar. Hooray! So I went to La Jolla and I stepped out. And I mean, you've been there. It was just like, like I am in Brian Wilson's head.
Yeah, I grew up in a beach town.
Yeah.
I grew up in Brian Wilson's neighborhood.
Yeah,
basically.
So it's it's like the thing of you just, so I guess maybe you don't necessarily know it, and like you see it for the first time and you go, my God, it's true.
No, I think that was my feeling in Hawaii. But we would have relatives and friends come to visit us in California. Everybody wants to go see the ocean. And kind of like, really? Because I grew up next to the ocean, so it wasn't a big deal to me. But then you start, like, you see it through somebody else's eyes and you realize, I guess if the biggest body of water you've ever seen is a lake, the ocean is pretty, mind-boggling.
Well, that's one of those things. You know, once I lived in Southern California, it just became so unutterably sad to me to think that there were people who would, like, be born, live their whole lives, and die in, like, Lincoln, Nebraska. And, like, that was their experience, you know? It's like where they're in, like, Bloomington, Indiana for 78 years, and they die on the second floor of a two-story hospital looking out at a blacktop roof. I'm like, well, this is how I'm ending my life, I guess. I think there is something about, I mean, I don't want to get too hippy-trippy about it. We got fish to fry here in a second, but I do think there is something psychological. Now, I won't say spiritual, but I think there's something psychological or emotional about people who grow up in places where there either are, how do I put this, not borders, but I mean, I think if you live in a place where you are at, you can see the ocean and the vast, endless expanse of water. I think there is something mentally that it does to you about picturing yourself and your potential in the world, as opposed to just growing up in a place where it seems like in every direction you look and there's nothing, like in the bad way, there's nothing.
Yeah, we used to visit friends in Sacramento, and there's something about going someplace where it's completely flat.
Yeah.
Where you can't even see mountains in the distance. It's just, there's just nothing. You look around and there's just nothing. And it's really depressing.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's the difference between living, I don't know, any place like that, like Fargo is the same way.
Well, and I also, growing up, I realized after having to go visit relatives in the desert and having traveled a little bit, I realized that I didn't want to live in the Los Angeles area anymore, but I didn't think I could ever live anywhere where there wasn't any water.
Right.
Because I grew up, just blocks away from water. And so Portland is great for that because every single day I see water. I don't have to pay a whole lot of attention to it. Usually I'm just driving across a bridge. But at least, but it's actually part of my, my world.
I always think of people who, they move to the United States, or maybe they move from some section in the Midwest to California because they have this image of what it's like, and then they end up in, like, Bakersfield. And then they're just sort of sitting looking around going, well, I guess this kind of sucks, too. Apparently California is also bad.
Oh, my dad's relatives were kind of like that. They made it all the way to the Los Angeles area. They made it all the way to Southern California. And then they settled in Lawndale, which is about, 5 miles inland. And it's just a hole. And it's kind of like, if you just moved another 5 more miles west, you'd be someplace cool.
We picked this randomly. It's called Oakland. Let's get all our things and go there now. What was I going to talk about? Yeah, it doesn't matter. Okay, so I'm going to call. Cheryl here. By the way, Cheryl, she wants. She notes here. Yes, in Hawaii, Cylons replaced our royalty. How great would that be? If you skipped right from having from monarchs to just a huge
robot overlord.
Just a huge cyborgian leader who strides across the land like Colossus. All right, let's see here. I'm going to dial Cheryl. I just want to confirm that I can. I want to double check that I can actually talk about something before I talk about
it.
Okay. All right, let's see if I can just. See if this works here.
Hello.
Hello, Cheryl. How are you?
I am good.
Hey, so you know that email that and you know the one I'm talking about, the one that you forwarded to me. Do you think that is a I will leave their last name out of it as I always do whenever I reference these folks. But if I don't identify their last name, you suppose I can read that on the air?
Absolutely.
All right. That's probably how they would want it.
Seriously, the email made my day.
All right. Actually, and by the way, here's one of the reasons why you're fantastic is because it made your day to read it and then to pass it along to me. And really, when you think about it, It's not an email that should have made anybody's day, you know, not mine, not yours, and yet it did, and I understand exactly why. So, awesome. All right. Excellent. Never mind. I was going to have you give the second clue up for E.H. Vending, but I'll do that later on. Don't.
No. Yeah, you do it.
Don't you worry. You're pretty little head. All right. Thank you, Cheryl.
Bye. You get paid the big bucks.
I was just pops and buzzes over here. I didn't whatever she said. All right, there you go. That's Cheryl. Okay, so I can read this now. So this is something that Cheryl forwarded to me this morning. Do you remember how, well, I think we've talked about this, how once upon a time there was a man, and that man's name was Rick Emerson. And Rick Emerson had one overriding lament slash wish. The lament was that no one had named their child after him.
Ah, yes.
The wish was that someone would give him just the smallest slice of, not immortality, but would extend his existence on this, on the Terra, on this humble planet of ours, by however many decades, by gracing a child with my name. And then to add insult to injury, there was some damn kid named Dylan Riley in the, I shouldn't say damn kid, I'm sure he's charming. Some listeners had a kid and they named him Dylan Riley, but that was just, they said it was a coincidence, but it was like, you could tell there was a whole like sparing my feelings thing. No, we didn't name him after Sarah Dillon, Tim Riley, not at all, you know, neurotic. And so I was just all like, you know, just irritated. And I was like, what is it? Which is the sort of thing that, like, saying it out loud, I guess it makes me sound like some sort of power mad dictator. That I was, you know, what does it take to get somebody to name their child after me? Come on! Which is also an indication of why it's good that I don't have any real power. Because, I mean, really, with just, like, even the minuscule, like, rodeo clown kind of power that I do have, what do? I immediately start berating parents for not naming their children after me at birth. Which seems like one step away from just having dissidents imprisoned somewhere and just and paving over their homes. So maybe it's for the benefit of all humanity that I don't, you know, have any real clout in this world.
I've always thought so.
Anyway, so but then things took a turn. My fortunes were reversed when a family. We don't use your name, but the parents named their daughter Emerson Ava, and so I think I've actually gotten it's almost like I've adopted one of those kids that's covered in flies, like in some other country, and they send you like you'll get a picture of your adopted, you know, whatever, like your foster kid every, but they don't say foster kid. What do they say?
I don't remember what it is, but
you know,
you're sponsoring a child.
Yeah, it's like, you know, little Huang who lives you know, like at, I don't know, who lives in a pile of dung somewhere in some horrible country. Like, you'll get a photo of him once a month or something, which you will never look at, by the way, because how depressing would that be? You know, hey, I'm in a new home. Oh, still living in dung. Ooh, right in the trash. I think that those envelopes come and they just go directly. Like, that's the thing. It goes in the shredder. It, like, you don't even open it. It's like one fluid motion from the mailbox to the dustbin.
And thank you so much for the money you send each month. I was able to buy a pencil to go to school. But I had to share it with the rest of the children in the class. But our village was so happy to get a pencil.
Thank you for the glorious pencil you have given me. Was best meal I have had all week. Now pants full of splinters, but thank you, wonderful American. Anyway, this child is not like that, I'm sure.
No.
Not covered in flies, certainly, from what I've seen. And so I got some pictures of Emerson Ava when she was first born. And then, about a year ago, Mom and Dad sent me some of these pictures. Like, here's Emerson Ava. Isn't she coming along? What a delightful child. And, you know, she's turning a lovely young lady. And she's however old, a couple years or something. So they sent me photos of, again, a child named after me, Rick Emerson. So this arrives this morning from Emerson Ava's parents, who are subscribers and listeners to the show. Subject line: canceling our subscription. Now, normally, that's a thing you wouldn't be very happy about. You say, oh, someone feels that they're not getting the 32 cents worth. Now, you know, I am sullen, and I feel besmirched. It just says this. Unfortunately, here's the thing. I can't be unhappy about this. It's like, I know I should. And I know that the business part of me should say, like, well, if somebody feels that they are not, you know, they get 32 cents and they're not getting an adequate return on that investment, what can we do to remedy this? I can't be unhappy about this, though. I'm not saying I'm happy about it as such. Well, you'll understand when I read it. Huh. Unfortunately, it says, little Emerson Ava has started mimicking the show. We've had a few shut-ups and goddams already. She's like two, by the way. So with regrets, we need to cancel. How do I go about this process? Thank you. I mean, do you see what I'm saying? It's like I can't be happy, but I can't be. But there is something sort of, I don't even want to say there's something wonderful about it, but I mean, but goddamn it. Oh, see there, I'm doing it again. There's something fantastic about that. Sort of like a closing of the circle. There is some sort of a, I feel like Elton John needs to appear and start singing a song about this or something. You know, where you just, it starts with something, goddamn. And then there's like a child who, you know, curses and then it's something. There's some sort of a great cyclical sort of evolution happening here. I don't even know how to put into words the feelings that I have when I read this email. It's very strange. When I told you that I had the most surreal email like ever to read.
Yes.
Not only is it about a child with my name, not only is it about a child named after me, who, by the way, I didn't father and have not met, but now the child's parents are having to cancel the subscription to the show because the child is mimicking me. So that's just great and weird Here's the thing. Someday, however many months, days, years, whatever from now, when the book of life is closed on Rick Emerson and he is nearing his final moments and he sits on the porch and he says, well, what did I do with my life? This is really one of those things that you could check off. You know, you can just say, you know, well, did I have a child named after me? Yes, I did. And then, you know, did I inadvertently corrupt that child and somehow achieve that small slice of immortality by passing along any number of my less desirable character traits into my namesake? Yes, I did. Check. Turn the page. Done.
Yeah. See, you'd think that they might have thought of that ahead of time.
Yeah.
Just the whole idea.
Like naming her Tiffany.
They name the child after you. They allow the child to listen to the show.
By the way, that's really the ill-advised thing here. That's the step that you should have left off the chart.
It's not surprising, then, therefore, when the child begins speaking, that occasionally the kid's just going to go, penis watch!
You know whose kid
or
does that?
Or just look sad and go, I am such a retard!
You know whose kid doesn't scream for ice cream, it screams for the penis watch? Our friend Jenny, her daughter, who I believe was like 7 at the time, kept going like, when are we going to hear a penis watch? Which is just like, that's the best thing ever. And I swear to God, I know that. I mean that in the least creepy way possible. Yeah. It really is just wonderful. I like to think that I'm making the world a better place. And if not,
better is a relative term sometimes, really.
I was going to say, you just walk around to the other side of that, and it's, and that frown is upside down. Because I feel like I am contributing a little bit of vitality and zest to the world.
Oh.
All right. Well, that's. I'm going to mention this again later on in the show, just so I can observe that some people named their kid after me. So I'll just read this one more time. Little Emerson Ava has started mimicking the show. We've had a few shut-ups and goddams already, so regrettably, we need to cancel. All right, that's from Emerson Ava's parents. All right. Let's see. Anything else on this list to get to? No. I got this link to show later on. We'll do this maybe, I don't know, in like 20 minutes or so. These awkward photos that I got sent yesterday, which are fantastic, by the way. All right, and I think that's it. I know that this is where I'm supposed to talk about stuff I did last night, but I honestly don't remember. I have no...
We both watched House.
Oh, yeah, we watched House, so we'll do a House recap later on. And I prepped for Outlook Portland, which is not tremendously exciting to talk about, but I will say that this morning I interviewed for Outlook Portland this guy, Chris Witherspoon, who David Walker recommended. Chris Witherspoon is a filmmaker originally from L.A., lives in Portland now, has for a while, and just did completed his second film. It's a horror film called Rage, which he is not shy about saying this, that it sort of takes its inspiration from Steven Spielberg's Duel. And I haven't seen the movie yet. David Walker has raved about it. I have actually seen, and again, I haven't seen it yet, but I have at one point online somewhere else, some reviewer actually did use the word, He used the phrase minor masterpiece to describe it. And I'm sure, I don't know, I haven't seen it, but I got to tell you, the guy, is Chris Witherspoon, is one of the best interviews we've ever had on Outlook Portland, seriously. So we're going to have him in, I think, next Tuesday to talk about the film, because it's screening next Thursday. And he's just, he's one of those guys you get like 15 seconds into a conversation with him, and you just think to yourself, like, I could talk to this guy for like 9 hours about movies and just the subtle nuance of cinema and the love of cinema and the things that drew him to it and what inspires him and the way that he writes and the way that he creates. He's just a fascinating guy. So that's going to air this Sunday in Outlook Portland, and then we'll have him on the show next Tuesday. So yeah, I watched House, and I guess I watched House, and I swear to God, I ironed a shirt, and I think I tied some socks together. So that was about it. You, Don Taylor?
I did some writing. I did some cookie baking for thing, and I also had mentioned this to you briefly, and you were like, "Save it! Don't tell me about it yet." And I didn't really even want to talk about it because it was so horrifying.
I really am having second thoughts about it now, but it's too late to turn back.
Yeah. A couple of days ago, a day or so ago, yesterday, I noticed, like night before last, that the cat had this kind of swollen place on its butt. Like it just on one side.
Are you listening, Emerson Ava?
Yes. My cat is she's a skinny, thin little cat. She had some flea problems, so she'd like been plucking the fur off of the back of her legs for some reason anyway, and that's all growing back. But she's just kind of hideous looking from behind right now anyway. And then she was walking away from Patrick and I the other night, and we went, what's wrong with her butt? She has like, ugh. So we pick up the cat, and I look, and she's got this swollen spot, and I touch it, and she goes, and I'm like, oh, God, there's something. She's got an abscess or God only knows what. So I go online and last night, and I look it up, and I'm like trying to figure out what it is, and I find that it could be, according to the internet, it could be.
Is this going to be a great phrase that we should tell everybody to be listening to? Listen up, you kids.
It could be an impacted anal gland. Like an infected or impacted
like
anal
three
gland.
Three things in a row I don't want to have to think about.
Yeah, and so I'm like, oh God, I don't want to deal with this.
What does impacted mean, by the way?
It means that it's whatever
when
it is.
When your teeth are impacted,
flowing.
I don't know what that means.
I think stuff just gets jammed in there and it keeps building up stuff and there's nowhere for it to go.
Why am I getting larger?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I'm like, oh God, so what am I supposed to do? So I look at it and it says that you're going to have to express the cat's anal gland. And
it's the worst thing that's ever been said.
And it says you can find out how to do this by looking on
YouTube.
Wait,
what does express mean?
That means squeeze.
Why couldn't they just say that? Why do they have to make it sound even momentarily more pleasant?
I don't know.
Express it. It makes it seem like, I don't know, like you're sending it somewhere.
Yeah. And the thing is that, you know, dogs and cats, they both have these scent glands on either side of their anus. And they can become, like, you know, infected or impacted or something, which is why when you take your dog to the vet, when you take your dog to the groomer,
they do that. There's
they'll
a
do
box
that for
it.
You.
I check that box every time. And here's the thing. Okay, I never thought
about
that.
It's something you don't want to have to do.
It never. Okay, here's the weird thing about this, because you actually had mentioned real glancingly yesterday. You're like, oh, and I got this horrible thing about the anal thing I don't want to talk about. And I'm like, no, whatever that is, it's got to be gold. It has anus in it. Is it when I take the dogs to the groomer, there's that box where you check off, like, what do you want done? Like, you want their ears cleaned? You want their tail, you know, shaped or whatever, where they, like, kind of sculpt the hair on the tail or something? And whatever, all the stuff you're checking off. And it's like, you know, something anal glands? I'm like, yes, because I don't ever want to have to deal with whatever that is. And I just check it. I never really thought about what the alternative is. The alternative is what's going on at your house.
Right. It's something that, and I had been through, and the thing is, Anna, just like with humans' bodies, animals' bodies are disgusting. And things happen. Like, I had a cat years ago that got acne. Because cats rub their chins on things to mark stuff with scent.
Yeah.
But a lot of times when cats have been fixed, male cats, they don't mark territory as much. And so the thing is, they're not rubbing the oily chin all over everything. And so they can get acne. And I had to, like, I would have to catch the cat, because after the first time the cat was like, stay away from me, I don't like you anymore. And I had to catch the cat and pin it down and squeeze its pussy chin and then put Oxy-10 on it.
Squeeze its pussy chin.
So yeah, so I'm like, I don't want to do, and that was disgusting, and that was the cat's chin.
I was going to say, the other end is going to be worse. It's not a chin you're
so I'm like, okay, well, how bad is this? And I go on YouTube, because they said you can see videos on YouTube. So I look, and there's this veterinarian.
Of course you can.
And the first video I look at is not bad. It's the veterinarian. He's got the cat. He lifts up the cat's tail. He has a piece of gauze. He puts his hand over the cat's butt with the gauze. He kind of squeezes. Then he removes the gauze.
This is so horrifying.
And it's done. And I'm like, that's not so bad.
Let me watch a second video.
Yeah, if only I had stopped there, because the next one I went to, there was no gauze. It was just somebody, a close-up of somebody with their thumbs, putting their thumbs on either side of the
cat. All right, yeah.
And this horrible pasty brown sludge came out, these two holes on either side of the cat's butt. And I swear to God, I was sitting there and I just went, ah! And Patrick walked in the room and he's like, what are you watching? And I was like, oh God, and I told him. And the thing is, because it actually made me queasy to watch this. So now, of course, I'm just like, I don't want to go near the cat. I don't want to have anything to do with the cat. But now I feel bad for the cat because there might be something wrong with the cat. So last night, Patrick and I both go in the bedroom and I get like a hot washcloth and I get a towel and I get rubber gloves.
You're
getting
rid of it.
Everything all set up.
Finding a rag to bite down on.
And we get the cat, and Pat picks up the cat and goes, you know, it really doesn't look bad anymore. And I look over, and it doesn't look swollen anymore. And I'm like, well, you know, she was, like, you know, licking it this morning. Maybe she fixed it herself. So I went over, and I kind of poked at it, and she didn't complain, and it wasn't swollen anymore.
The issue has resolved.
And so I was like, oh, thank God.
Wow, that is the definition of just of...
Thank God.
Yeah. I mean, that is a near miss. I mean, that is really when the bullet when it goes through your sleeve and grazes your elbow but doesn't actually strike you.
I was so grateful. I'm like, I don't know what you did to fix yourself, cat, but God bless you. Here, have some pounce. Have extra pounce.
That's one of those things where you're almost tempted to believe in the Almighty because you'd like to think that he might show you a kindness like that in the future.
Ugh.
By the way, you'll be happy to know that Cheryl has actually gone out of her way on Skype to find the vomit emoticon. Which, like all of the Skype emoticons, is animated. And so it's a smiley face that looks at you, and then again, like a pasty brown sludge comes out of the emoticon. So,
and I'll tell you, if you ever want to do, like, the video rodeo to people ever again, I would suggest you go find one of those videos of someone expressing cat's anal glands. Because, dear God.
I was going to ask if that might make for an interesting contest at some point.
God, that was horrible.
Wonderful. All right, then.
So... thankfully, I did not have to act. And also, I will just say to listeners, always check that box at the groomer and the vet, because you don't ever want to have to do that.
No, the thing is, I didn't even know what it was involved with it. I just saw like anal and glands. I was like, I'm not doing that. And, you know, and I just had whatever. You know,
yes,
it's like,
you can do that for me, whatever it is.
Yeah, I have never. Thomas Gilger says, don't make me turn off the show for everyone. All right. My final thought on that would be, that's like, that is a good news, bad news, because it's like, it's being shown something so horrible and so repellent, but then you get the relief of like, it's like having a terrible nightmare, but then you get to wake up and go, oh my God, just a dream. That's what that is. You're like, oh my God, I have to what? Oh, I'm going to hurl. But then you don't have to do it.
And I was so extra nice to the cat all evening. Like, oh, bless you, kitty.
Who fixes her own anus?
Have some treats. Thank you for fixing your butt.
Hey, my final observation here. If there isn't already, there ought to be some sort of a 70s family themed porn film called Anus Enough. There you go. Anus Enough.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Still getting over that last story.
My only request here is that you don't do the Joy of Christmas at first. I realize I have to reload that sound because I'd removed it from the because I didn't think we were going to be using it because, you know, January 25th.
Who knew?
Yeah.
An overturned tractor trailer in Kansas City, Missouri that spilled hundreds of pigs onto the roadway closed the ramp from northbound Interstate 435 to northbound I-35 in Clay Como, Missouri for about 5 hours Monday. It happened just before 9 a.m. The Highway Patrol said the driver was on his way from a small town in Kansas to a small town in Iowa when he lost control of the truck on the exit ramp. As a result, the truck fell down the embankment. About 700 pigs needed to be rescued after the truck overturned. I looked for good pictures of this. I found
one. How could there not be video of this?
There is a little bit of video. There was one very small picture. I couldn't find really good pictures of it.
Well, that seems... What the hell are we... What are we making cameras for?
The driver of the truck was not injured. About 35 to 40 pigs that escaped died from injuries sustained in the crash. But considering there were 700 pigs involved.
But now we will consume their tasty courage.
Right. The exit ramp was closed from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m.
All right. Well, fair enough.
Pigs.
Say it with disdain, like it's their fault, like they did it somehow.
They might have had something to do.
Swine. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Don't forget, coming up at the bottom of the hour, about 12 minutes from now, we'll talk to Mr. Eric D. Snyder, who is at the Sundance Film Festival. Later on, Training Watch, Taser Watch, Joy of Christmas, top five posthumous albums of all time. Here is Don Taylor.
In fact, let's do our Cheney Watch now.
All right. Here is your Cheney Watch for, what the hell is today, Tuesday or Wednesday?
Tuesday.
It's Tuesday. Here's your Cheney Watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
Wow. Every time I see you looking my way, baby, baby, can't you hear my heartbeat? Baby, baby, can't you hear my heartbeat? Baby, baby.
Here is Don Taylor with your Cheney Watch.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney said late last week in an interview on the Today Show that at some point he'll have to make a decision about whether to seek a heart transplant.
Uh-huh.
Cheney has in the past experienced atrial fibrillation, an irregular rhythm of the upper chambers of the heart, and last summer he received a left ventricle assist device to help him regain function he'd lost. John Kobashigawa, one of the authors of the transplant guidelines developed by the International Society for Heart and Lung Transplantation, said that there are guidelines dealing with the clinical factors that make someone eligible for a transplant. Normally end-stage heart failure with a high chance of death within a year. Potential recipients have poor scores on measures of heart pumping efficiency and the ability to consume oxygen during an exercise session. But age is also a factor. The guidelines say that, generally speaking, heart transplants are considered an option for eligible patients age 70 and under. Cheney turned 70 on January 30th. But that doesn't necessarily mean he has to make the decision in the next year, because the guidelines also say that carefully selected older patients may also be considered.
I mean, what?
I.e., rich guys, well, rich white guys.
And also just, you know, that this story is, you know, sometimes you'll hear something called a test balloon. This isn't even really that. This is just sort of a cover story. Like, they're just putting that out there so they can feign that there was ever, like, a question that he was going to get the heart. When you know that, like, right now, he's just driving along in some sort of black-tinted, car, like Michael Douglas in Wall Street, and just going, her, I want her right there. And him, too. Well, who knows? The first two might not take. Grab him. And the baby, you know, and he's just, you know, they're all going in a gunny sack and they're going back to his office.
See, I just assume he already has three or four people already, like, put up in a hotel somewhere, and they're just, like, exercising and eating healthy foods every day. And he's promised, like, a giant sack full of cash to whoever's heart he takes when he needs to harvest it.
At some point, I'm going to have to come and take one of your internal organs. So, nothing personal.
But I will give your family a gazillion dollars I need it.
You know, let me just say this because I can't not. Have you ever? Never mind. I was going to ask about that Johnny Depp film, the Brave. Oh, never mind. Let's forget it. Okay. Forget I even mentioned it. You don't want to know.
No.
If you don't know, you don't want to know.
I really don't.
All right. So, in any event, Dick Cheney has had, what, four heart attacks? And he's like, I don't know, like 1,000 years old or something?
They say he's about to turn 70, and I find
There's
that
no
hard
way.
To believe.
There is no way. He is completely
age-shaving. He's only 70?
No. That is a transparent falsehood right there. That's a fiction.
Yeah, no, that's...
All right. There you go. There's your Cheney Watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
Every time I see you looking my way, baby, baby, can't you hear my heartbeat? Baby, baby, can't you hear my heartbeat? Baby, baby...
There you go. There's your Cheney Watch. Let's do a couple more. We'll take a break. We'll come back with Mr. Eric Snyder, who's live at the Sundance Film Festival.
If you have ever had the suspicion that the beef in your Taco Bell chalupa might not exactly be all beef, then your suspicions were correct. According to a class action lawsuit filed last week in California, the meat mixture that Taco Bell uses in its products contains less than 35% meat, according to the Associated Press.
What is the rest?
Well, the rest is binders and extenders.
Binders and extenders. That's so horrible.
Such as water, wheat oats, soy lecithin, maltodextrin, anti-dusting agent, and modified cornstarch.
These all sound... Here's the thing. In and of themselves, no one ingredient on that list seems horrifying. But together, it just seems completely unhealthy and like a thing. It just seems like I'm something they're going to be hanging on the wall of a general store, Malala, and giving me plastic eyes, like an anti-dusting agent. What is that?
I don't know. I know maltodextrin is a filler, and it's also used in a lot of flavoring things. It's like they say modified cornstarch. That's used to thicken the mixture. Soy lecithin is also a filler. Wheat, oats, that sort of thing. The class action suit is saying that it sort of misses the mark for USDA standards for food labeled as beef.
Well, and also the phrase binding agents, I find that to be especially off-putting.
Yeah, anti-dusting agent, I think, is something that is just added to powdered things so the powder doesn't fly around
when
as
you
much.
Open the package, it stays in the bag.
Yeah.
This is Taco Bell or Taco?
This is Taco Bell.
Taco Bell. So I worked at Taco Time, and it was much the same way, where like the meat – strangely, it didn't have to be refrigerated. It was just these weird white plasticky bags full of, I don't even know how to describe it. It was like really, really, really finely ground granola is sort of what it looked like.
And then you just reconstitute it with water?
You would dump it, into a huge, like a kettle, like a cauldron thing, basically. And then you would just, and then there was like a huge, like, boat oar spoon. And you pulled a lever, and some hot water went and sprayed it. And then you went, and you just stirred it around. I swear to God, it was like you were conjuring up Smurfette. You were just going, and then at some point, now here's the weird thing about this, because I can remember opening the plastic bag. I can remember dumping it in. I remember sludging it up. But I don't think I was ever around for the stage when it left the cauldron and became actual meat or, whatever that they were putting in the taco. So either I'm just not remembering it, or I blocked it out, or I wasn't privy to that stage of the operation because it was, like eyes only sort of knowledge. So I don't really know how it went, like what the final, like how does it get from being the one to being the other? I mean, if it's just like a bunch of powdery sludge and you're adding water, like at some point. Well, I guess they must just boil it until it has this sort of meat-like.
Well, if you add hot water to it, it'll reconstitute. It's dehydrated meat and cornstarch, and then hot water the cornstarch and the hot water will thicken, and it's essentially the same thing. It's you're using dehydrated meat along with what is essentially those packets of taco seasoning that you buy from Schilling. That are just sort of, sugar and filler and cornstarch and seasoning.
By the way, I think I speak for everybody when I say the phrase dehydrated meat also shouldn't be that horrifying, and yet it is for some reason.
Yeah. I've always kind of, I have to admit, having gone through the whole culinary school process and had to take classes in restaurant management and the whole process of making sure that your menu items are you don't have any menu items that only use like one thing,
right?
Because that's really wasteful. You want to be able to, create multiple dishes from your stock, basically. That the ultimate inefficiency in that way is Taco Bell, because almost everything Taco Bell sells are just variations on exactly the same thing. It's that meat mush and some kind of tortilla and some kind of cheese.
A cheese food.
Yeah, and it's like, but in this form, it's a burrito. In this form, it's a taco. In this form, it's a chalupa. But it's all exactly the same thing.
So they're basically like a can of Play-Doh, and then it's just like, what shape is the extruder?
Yeah.
It's a star. It's a crescent. It's a circle. It's spaghetti.
And then they reached this point where it was kind of, we've run out of things to invent. I know. Let's like glue a tortilla to the outside of a hard shell taco using cheese, and then we'll call it a crunch supreme-orama.
Here's the thing at Taco Bell. This is actually the moment when I realized that I could no longer eat there. It was on one and it's not like I was under the impression it was health food or anything. And I'm not opposed to junk food or the occasional drive-through or whatever. Look, we all fall short of the glory of God. But there was some night, and it's that thing where like do you do this sometimes? Do you order more than you need or more than you should because you have? And it's not like I grew up. It's not like I grew up in the grapes of wrath or something. But we had a big family, a lot of kids, and my parents didn't have a great deal of money. So sometimes there was not – when I say there wasn't enough food, I mean that makes it sound more destitute than it was. But it was like you sometimes wish there was a little more than there was and whatever. And so, but like I'm still here, so it wasn't that bad. But I think maybe as some weird as some weird manifestation of that. And I think also the fact that just for the longest time, I had like no money ever. I mean, it was just like dead broke, like all the time. So I fell into something like whenever I had the opportunity to order food, I would just order like way more than I needed, because that was so much, that was so far preferable to just needing more food than I had and then just sort of, you know, lamenting it, having not quite enough. So I was at Taco Bell one night, and I don't know why I did this, but it's like I did, you know, I had like a smattering of tacos and whatever. And then I swear to God, I had not one. But I ordered, first of all, not one, but two of their Mexican pizzas. And it's like, which is, as you just said, I mean, it's just some paste and some glue and some crap and some schmutz and some mash shoved onto a thing. And then they get that caulking gun out and they go, and they just like, and they shoot sour cream and like green mush all over it. And then they go, and then you stick another tortilla shell on top of it. And then it's like, I don't know. And then they just and then they just dust it, you know, with yet another smattering of dehydrated meat, which is then sealed to the top of it with some sort of horrible pasty substance. And they hand it to you. And I ordered, as a free thinking adult, I ordered two of those, and then I ate two of them. And I don't know why. I don't know why, because like as I finished the first one, I thought, I shouldn't eat anymore. But it's like then my hands weren't listening. It was like I had some sort of Seth Green problem where the hand was thinking on its own. It was already shoving the Mexican pizza into my mouth. And I got about halfway through it, and I did reach some moment of clarity. I reached some snapping point in my own head where I thought, this is bad, and it's bad for me. And it was like I could almost feel my duodenum just cinching up in protest and just saying, we refuse. You know what it is? It's like when they deliver a package to you and you just go like, refuse, return to sender. And it was like all of my peristaltic functions were just going, no, and just starting to push back. And that was the last time I ever went to Taco Bell.
Taco Bell is sort of like the culinary equivalent of the booty call to the like really skanky girlfriend that you know you might be able to you're probably going to catch something from. It's like a really bad decision you make at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you think, well, you know, it's good enough. It'll do. It'll be satisfying in its way.
Well, she's only got sores on the top half.
Yeah. And then what happens is, like, you wake up later and you're just miserable and unhappy and everything burns. And you think, why? Why did I do that?
Life. All right. There you go. Was that a watch of some kind, or was that just horrible?
No, that was just news. That was just horrible news.
All right. Well, in any event, Eric Snyder is supposed to be calling, I don't know, about now?
Yeah, around
now. Is it roughly the same time?
He said 2:30.
What is your gut sense? Should we just stick with it here, or should we take a break?
Let's take a break, and then...
You want to get ring him up?
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure he'll call momentarily. He's
all right. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. Don't forget, still to come today, we get your Taser Watch, Joy of Christmas, your top five posthumous albums of all time. We'll talk to Mr. Eric D. Snyder at the Sundance Film Festival, and we'll do your second clue for the E.H. Vending Contest for this week. Stay right there. We return momentarily. Go nowhere.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
And if I can't, I'll cry and cry. You are.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. In just a few moments, we'll be joined by Mr. Eric D. Snyder, who is live at the Sundance Film Festival, and also writes for Cinematical and Film.com, and we'll have him weigh in on all the happenings. Did he see, what is it, The Woman, The Women?
Yes.
Is it Woman or Women?
Women, I
The Women. So it was a horror film last night for the guys who did the company who did Open Water.
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll check in with him about that. Still to come today, we got your Taser Watch, your Joy of Christmas, and so forth. Don't forget today's program brought to you by Squires Electric. Good people all. You can find out more about them by going to squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609. That's 503-252-1609 because your home's electrical system, not unlike the insides of Mr. Dick Cheney or the inside of whatever it is you have recently purchased from one of our city's finer Mexican drive-thru establishments. Because, you know, you kind of have a general idea of what's in there. As Nelson Muntz would say, it's just kind of guts and black stuff. But you don't really, you know, beyond that, it's a bit of a mystery. You're piercing the veil at that point. You have no idea where you tread. Some of you are screwing around with your electrical system. Even if you don't maim yourself, it's just going to take a long time. It's going to cost you money. It's going to cost you time, which is a different kind of money, and you're going to get further behind. It's going to be frustrating, and you're going to end up hiring somebody to do it anyway. So you can be ahead of the game. You can stay ahead of the curve by having somebody who specializes in this do it from the outset. That is Squires Electric. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical contractors, installers, and supervisors, and they're based right here in Portland. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, 503-252-1609. And as we've said before, if it's that thing where, like a girlfriend, boyfriend, husband, wife, somebody who feels like they really do understand the electrical system in the house, and maybe they do, but maybe you just prefer that they've spent their time doing something else. Or if it's that thing where the ceiling fan does get hung eventually, but I mean, it just becomes like a war of attrition where they're in the, you know, and it's like they're having to go out of there, having to buy, honey, I need rebar and five sheets of, you know, of five blocks of concrete, and I need 17 caulking guns and 4 gallons of paint and a shaking machine. It's just because they don't quite have the efficiency part down. So you skip to the bottom of the page, get it done right the first time. SquiresElectric.com or 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. In just one moment, we'll be joined by Mr. Eric D. Snyder, who is live at the Sundance Film Festival. You just looked at your screen and cringed.
Oh, well, I was reading this. Somebody recounting that they had gone to the a midnight screening of this film, The Woman, which is called, and that in the middle of the film, a couple sitting next to them just basically trampled them to get out of the theater, didn't say excuse me or anything, asked me that, just stepped on them to get out as quickly as possible. And he said they assumed they must have just been sort of horrified by it, because apparently it is a very graphic movie. That's it, it's a very good movie, really well crafted and very realistic with great performances, but also that there's a lot of carnage and there's some torture and some domestic abuse. And apparently, these people were just kind of, you know, a little squeamish. But then when they left the theater, couple were basically they were ranting. A guy stood up during the Q&A out of nowhere and started shouting at the director about the movie being misogynistic and degrading to women, and that it should never have been made into a movie or shown to anyone for any reason.
Does this contain one of my very favorite phrases in all the world when it's used in a news story? And then the night descended into chaos. Sounds very much like that was the case.
Yeah, they said that there was an entire section of people who'd worked on the film. The director, Lucky McKee, was there. And, this guy just started screaming at them.
Well, this is like that, we should actually, Eric D. Snyder's on the phone here. So without further ado, we will quit our yapping. And we'll go to Eric D. Snyder, who writes for film.com. Also Cinematical, also EricDSnyder.com. You can hear him Fridays from... I'm going through different versions of Hooray for Hollywood. This is one of those ones that's played on that organ like your grandma had with the weird flippy keys on top, like marimba, salsa. You can actually hear the keys being depressed. You can hear him Fridays, Movie BS with Bear and Snyder, Cascadia.fm from 11 to noon, immediately preceding a fine program called Legion of News. He is at the Sundance Film Festival. A good friend, Eric D. Snyder. Hello, sir. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Hold on. There's too much Hollywood harangue happening in the background. I have to diminish the.
I understand.
All right, there we go. It is Tuesday. How long has Sundance been going on? When did it actually kick off?
It officially kicked off Thursday night.
Okay, Thursday night. So you've been there for a few nights now. How many films have you seen at this point?
I think I'm up to 16. I think.
And of the 16 films, so you saw this film we were just discussing, the women,
the woman,
which is from the Open Water folks. So we'll talk about that here in just a second. I am now legally obligated to ask, as a hack DJ. So have you seen anybody famous, Eric Snyder?
I saw Rutger Hauer at a party the other night.
Really? Did you?
I did, because Rutger Hauer is in a movie called Hobo with a Shotgun.
Is he
yes.
ever? Oh, yeah.
Wait, let me tell you what it's about.
Here's what's fantastic about Hobo with a Shotgun, other than, like, everything. By the way,
right.
I will just say that I spent, like, a goodly amount of time last night here's what a nerd I am. I wasn't even, like, on the site for Hobo with a Shotgun. I was actually on the site for the guy, Russ Howard, who did the score for Hobo with a Shotgun, because
wow.
he was offering five pieces from the score, five movements from the film available as downloads. I'm like, oh, my God, how can I not do it? And so I went there and, of course, you could have my information, my email, my phone number, sure, whatever you want. Just give me the Hobo with a Shotgun music.
I'm seeing that movie tonight. I haven't seen it yet, but saw Rutger Hauer. And that's probably the most famous person I've seen, actually. I haven't been hanging out in the places where the famous people are.
Oh, my God. Well, once you've seen
Rutger Hauer,
who else do you really need to see at that point? I was actually for Outlook Portland this morning. I was interviewing this guy named Chris Witherspoon, who's a filmmaker who's made this horror movie in Portland called Rage. And I swear to God, we went to a break, and one of the first things that he brought up, he goes, "Hey, so how about that Hobo with a Shotgun? Hey, it's like all anybody wants to talk about." So you will see that tonight.
I'm looking forward. Yeah, I'm seeing that tonight. I'm looking forward to it because a friend of mine said that it looks like a movie that was made in 1978. And the reason it wasn't released until now is that the guy who made it was a criminal.
Awesome.
So I'm looking forward to that.
And on the subject, before we get off the subject of you seeing famous people, by the way, I need you to do me a favor. If you see Monique, punch her in the face for me.
If I see who?
Monique.
Oh, Monique.
I'm sorry.
Oh,
you might,
I don't think she's here.
You might know her better as Academy Award-winning actress Monique.
I do. I believe, wasn't she one of the ones reading off the nominees this morning?
She was.
Yeah, so she's not here.
Okay,
so,
well, just in case she just shows up briefly and you cross paths, because you know my feelings about Monique.
I do. I'll pass those along in fist form.
Thank you.
You guys were talking about The Woman.
Yes.
And the brouhaha that erupted at its premiere Sunday night. Don, what were you reading from? Who wrote the article?
This was actually Nathan Anderson.
Okay. Because Drew McWeeny of HitFix.com, formerly of Ain't It Cool News, he was there, and he told me about it. That it was people walked out during the film like they do, and then at the end during the Q&A, this crazy guy just was ranting and raving. And apparently, there's a video of some of that on YouTube that I haven't seen yet. And I guess the video doesn't capture all of it; it's just sort of the tail end of it. But Drew said it was quite an event.
And Drew McWeeny, by the way, people would they would know his writing as Moriarty on Ain't It Cool.
That's right, yeah, he was more earlier back in Nathan Lewis. For a long time, I thought Drew McWeeny was his made-up name.
Only
to discover that, no, it's actually his name.
Yeah, you do understand why he would hew to the fictitious side of things name-wise. What was your take on the movie? What are your thoughts?
I don't know what my take on the movie is. It's a very odd movie. Many parts of it are black comedy, and I get that they want you to laugh at how absurdly misogynistic it is, how awful this main character is. And then it eventually is just sort of your basic revenge, you know, female empowerment kind of thing. But it was parts of it are hard to watch, and parts of it, I thought of a press screening last night, and a lot of people were laughing a lot. And I sort of laughed here and there, but overall didn't find it particularly funny, even in a black comedy way. But some other people were just howling.
Is this
I don't know.
When you say that it's a sort of a female empowerment thing, is this the sort of the I spit on your grave female empowerment where it's like, you know, they spend
kind of like that. It's not quite that bad because the things that are done to her that require revenge aren't as awful as that. But it's that same general idea of we're going to show you some people being awful to this woman so that you'll love it when she gets revenge and saws them in half later.
Did you stick around to see like some sort of this chaos that erupted? I mean, was there a sense that things were kind of spinning out of control?
The chaos was Sunday night at a public screening, and I saw it last night. It was just a press screening, okay. So we didn't have – there was no Q&A or chaos. But the press all seemed to like it, so I don't know what that says about film journalists.
Is it the first movie that those guys have made since Open Water?
You've got those mixed up. The Open Water people made Silent House.
Oh, okay. All right. So I'm conflating the two.
This is the guy who made a film called May.
Yeah, this is Lucky McKee.
Okay. I did have those two backward. It reminds me a little bit of I saw this. There was this interview with David Fincher, and he talked about when they did a public screening, like the very first, like in Westwood or someplace, they did like a screening for the public of Seven. And he said that he and Brad Pitt were standing at the back of the theater, and Brad Pitt was sort of like trying to be incognito, and nobody knew what David Fincher looked like at that point. So
sure.
The people are all the test group is walking out of seeing Seven. And he said that it was one of the most conflicted moments of his filmmaking career up to that point, when as some women were leaving the screening for Seven, they actually just were saying to each other, they were muttering aloud, "The people who made that movie should be killed." Would you sort of aim for that, I think, maybe in some horrible way?
Yeah, I guess what better response could a filmmaker get?
Yeah. What else really? Are you going to be seeing today at Sundance?
See, what else? Well, today I'm going to see Hubble with a Shotgun. I'm trying to keep it classy. You know, I want to see all the Oscar contenders.
Of course.
Before everybody else goes out of the way. I just saw a really good one called The Lie. It's about this guy, you know, young married man with a young baby who tells a dumb lie to get out of work, and the dumb lie is that his baby has died. And then, you know, hilarity ensues.
Of course, as it always
it's
does.
It's a very Seinfeld kind of plot, but then what's cool is that it plays the dark comedy for a while, but then it also explores, like, the real issues involved here of how, you know, him not wanting to grow up and be responsible and all that, and it was pretty good. I really liked it. It has a Portland reference. The guy and his wife are talking about maybe moving to Portland, and they're talking to this hippie dippy girl played by Alia Shawkat from Arrested Development,
right?
Maybe, and she's all, "Oh, I love Portland. I met an owl there once that really showed me the way to go."
I never have any sense of how these. I don't really know how the logistics of Sundance work, but everything the festival goes for however long, and then on the final night or the final couple of nights, there's, you know, they do like a sort of grand awarding of all of the various prizes, like the grand jury prize and all that. What is the timeline for the awarding of all that stuff? Is it all like in one evening, or how does that work?
Yeah, the festival kicked off last Thursday, and it officially ends this Sunday. And this Saturday night will be the closing night award ceremony and party. And then Sunday, it's mostly screenings of the film that won. So, like, people have bought a ticket for Sunday at noon, and the ticket just says winner of whatever category,
right.
And then you'll see that film on Sunday.
Is there any like sense or any sort of any sort of scuttlebutt as to who the early favorites or the early contenders are for winning things?
That's a good question. Who are the early contenders? Sitting here with some of my colleagues. What's going to win the grand jury? Last year, the grand jury winner was Winter's Bone, which was just today nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars.
That was announced by Academy Award-winning actress Monique Dawn Taylor, in case you were winning.
That's right. Right. This year, usually the grand jury prize is going to be something usually fairly serious and usually young talent. There's a film called Pariah. Yeah, multicultural is another big thing. There's a film called Pariah about black teenage lesbians in Brooklyn. You can't go wrong with black teenage lesbians.
No, I always say that.
As far as pleasing the jury.
In film as in life, that really is the key to happiness. Let me. Somebody has actually asked. Let's see here. We've got 1 second here. Somebody is asking. A listener wants to know if you have seen anything about or heard anything about. There is apparently a documentary playing there about about the hip hop group, about a tribe called Quest. So I guess there's a documentary about the group there.
There's a tribe called Quest documentary. I didn't see it. I've talked.
It's actually pretty good.
People are saying it's pretty good. I've heard from several people that it is really good.
Okay.
I haven't seen it, but the word on the street is that it is what you would want it to be, apparently.
I love the idea that you are bringing us the word on the street from the hood of Park City, Utah. By the way, here's the greatest thing about Park City. This is that city in a nutshell. I don't know if it's still the same way, but it's like, it's one of those places where it's like the entire joint seems to be run by one of those like homeowners associations, because even like the 7-Eleven is done in like blonde wood and like teak paneling.
Even the Burger King looks like a ski lodge. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. We will let you get back to your day. So enjoy the hobo with a shotgun, as though there's any way you couldn't.
And, I know, right?
And we will. I look forward to hearing all about that, because I'm telling you, that is just if it's like 1/10 as good as the trailer, I mean, I'll be happy.
Right. I will. I'll keep you informed.
Awesome. There you go, Mr. Eric D. Snyder, ladies and gentlefolk. Don,
Eric.
Did you have any? All right.
No,
there you go.
Just
thanks.
Bye, Don.
Thank you, my friend. All right, there you go. That's Eric D. Snyder from ericdsnyder.com, also film.com and Cinematical. And I always just say Cinematical, but it is also Cinematical.com, right? Okay. Or .com, as you would say. Movie BS with Baron Snyder, Fridays 11 to noon at Cascadia.fm.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
You look puzzled, confused, flummoxed.
No, I'm just going over in my head the difference between .com and .com.
Everybody knows exactly what I'm talking about. This is, it's one of the three things that you constantly pronounce in a strange fashion. I'm not going to tell you the other two. Nor am I going to tell you how you pronounce it. But everybody who's listening to me, and I'm not just saying this to get inside your head. This isn't like I'm psyching you out or something. This really is true. And I'm not saying you pronounce them incorrectly. You do have...
Do most people say .com? Like, they don't say .com?
See, but now you're overthinking it. See, now you're getting... Now you're just going on some sort of a... Like, you're on some sort of a weird, like, tape loop in your head of it. I'm sure I do the same thing. People have a sort of trademark... Not even accents in the dialectical sense, but accents in the stressing sense of the word. You stress certain phrases and multi-part words... unconventionally, let's say that, and I do the same thing. Sometimes for zany effect, sometimes not, and then sometimes zany effect just becomes like the way that I say, like how I'm incapable of saying program. It's always just program, like robot became robot. I think because of Futurama or something. I mean, we're an army of robots. You know, it just became the thing I did. So, or I have to like always shout certain things like Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yeah,
and I don't know why. It's just a thing that I do. All right, here's Don Taylor.
Let's do our Joy of Christmas.
Here's your Joy of Christmas, I swear to Christ, for January 25th, 2011.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. And a Happy New Year.
Awesome. Here's your Joy of Christmas with Don Taylor.
The Lake Oswego Fire Department says a dry Christmas tree is to blame for a house fire in Lake Oswego on Friday night.
I see where you were going now. See, I wasn't quite sure how it was going to work. I couldn't quite piece together in my head exactly why we would be doing this and why it was. And you said it was still current. And I thought, well, how can that possibly be? It's also clear to me now.
Yes.
Okay.
The tree, keep in mind, again, this is January 25th. The tree fell onto a coffee table where a candle was burning, and the flames quickly spread. The homeowner called 911 to report heavy smoke coming from the house. By the time fire crews arrived, flames had engulfed the home.
Who called the fire department?
The homeowner.
He didn't call to say, oh my God, there's a fire?
No, he reported a heavy smoke. She. She was taken to the hospital with burns to her arms and hands, but is expected to be okay. One cat died in the fire. A small dog named Elvis and another cat survived.
Well, as long as the dog is okay. But let's get back to the...
Firefighters found them wet and hungry in the basement.
I mean, well, here's the thing. I mean, what a strangely specific yet totally inaccurate way to describe this when you're calling the fire department. You're not calling the Department of Smoke Removal. You're calling, I don't know, there seems to be a clouding in the air. There's some sort of a haze happening.
My house is full of smoke, and I don't know why.
It seems to be getting warmer and brighter, but for reasons I can't quite quantify.
It seems to be coming from that dry Christmas tree that fell onto the candle.
Right. Like, why would you not just go, oh, my God, there's a fire. You have to help. What about poor Snuzzles in the basement? Hey, by the way, this raises an interesting question. And by interesting, I don't mean that. What do I do with my tree?
You still have your tree?
Well, I mean, I haven't got rid of it as such.
Mm.
It's not gone per se.
Mm.
There's a way in which you could paint the scenario in which my tree is still, you know, I haven't gotten rid of it. It could be looked at that way.
Well, if
I could burn it, but that seems to end badly.
If your neighborhood has a large item pickup coming up once a month or something.
How would I know that?
You would contact whoever hauls your garbage.
How do I find them? Who are those people?
You'd get a bill from them. Don't you get a bill from the garbage collection?
I rent, baby. That's I don't know. Rick Emerson, I have people for that.
It's probably on the side of the bins.
Which bin?
The big
blue thing?
Yeah.
Not the blue one. Well, the one that you put yard crap in?
Well, either one. I mean, they provide you with trash cans, don't they?
Yes. Yeah, well, but I mean, the tree's not going to fit in a trash can.
No, but it says on the side who the trash company is, and you call them.
Oh, and I call them and say, hey, what's up with it? When are you going to come by?
Or you could get somebody who has a truck or something, and you could take it to Metro, to the dump.
Is there an actual dump?
Or you can actually call. You can also give them to places that grind stuff up for landscaping places that grind up tree bark and stuff. You can call them and ask them if they will take it.
Here's the great thing about your help, and it's the most relative kind of help because it doesn't actually get me. It gets me like half an inch closer to a solution because all of your suggestions is now. It's not like I'm not grateful. I'm just saying it's interesting because all of your solutions basically take the form of like. Well, there's a guy, and you get in touch with him.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, who, what, how do I, what guy? And you're like, you know, the people who do the thing. And I'm like, well, what, who are, what do you mean? What company that grinds things? And you're like, the folks who do it. And
well, how did you get rid of your trees in the past?
Here's the funny thing about that, too. I don't remember.
Did you have Boy Scouts come pick it up?
Because no.
I know that there were Boy at some point there would have been Boy Scouts, but I seriously doubt the Boy Scouts are doing it at this
wouldn't
late
have
date.
Boy Scouts at my home.
I did that 1 year.
No, Boy Scouts at your home, and then the next thing there's gypsies coming by. Mm. No, I don't think so. I think I may have just, I swear to God, I think I may have just gone to like to Craigslist and just looked for like guy picking up stuff. You know, for like, you know, $15. And then he came by. In fact, I'm pretty sure that I did that, if not last year, 2 years ago, because the guy came by and it was like this sort of, he was like, you know, we'll pick up stuff for $15, you know, or donation. I'm like, okay, well, whatever. So I called the guy and he came by. I think it was like 2 years ago. And he comes by and he was like in this, it was like you could just hear the Green Acres theme playing as he came around the corner, sort of. It's like you expected there to be like a bear in the front blowing on like a jug or playing a Jew's harp or something. And I was just like looking up front and it did everything but go like and backfire when he turned it off. And I looked at it was a truck with like those where it's a pickup truck, but in the back they have increased the amount of load that it can carry by just putting those like wooden slats on the side or something like little ladders or whatever. And it was like, I swear to God, in the back there was just like. There was like full on trash cans where people are clearly not just emptying cans. They were throwing the cans away as well because like the whole cans are going to. And then there was at least one mattress and a TV in the back. And I think he just like stuck. And if memory serves, and I think it does, the tree actually was like the last thing he was picking up that day. And that they couldn't the bungee and the twine. There were so many things in the back of the truck. The bungee and the twine could actually not fit around the tree. And I think that they were trying to fit it around by looping it literally like underneath the truck, which seems like a terrible idea because then it's touching the whatever, the
axle.
No, there's that thing down there that throws off all the heat. It's not the converter. Yeah. It's the whatever, like the, you know, it's a thing. And it touches dry grass sometimes. It'll set stuff on fire. But I think they were actually looping the twine like around the truck. But it was actually so large that they couldn't get the twine around. If I remember correctly, I swear to you, and I'm not just making this up because it's like some okie finokie fantasy that I'm having. As the truck was driving off, I think Laura and I looked out the window in sort of like a plausible deniability kind of way. And one of the compatriots that was along was actually just laying sort of face down, spread eagled on top of the pile of stuff and hooking a hand under each like sort of side rail.
Nice.
And sort of a, you know, all right, Cletus, roll on out. And then they just sort of down off to, you know, to sit with Emmett Otter and crew.
Well, in your neighborhood.
In my neighborhood.
Conceivably, you could just take it out to the curb and just lay it there and someone will come take it in
just
the middle of the night.
Put a thing on that says take if want.
No, you don't. No,
free.
You don't do that because then people know that you don't want it. Actually, actually, if you want someone to steal it, you put it like a sign out that says $5.
Right.
But if you just put it out there, someone might just take it to take it. Of course, also someone could just set it on fire. Either way, you're out. You're dead with your tree.
Thanks for putting that idea out there. By the way, I appreciate that. Okay.
I would say either take it to Metro and pay to dump it, or call a landscaping company who offers like wood chips and stuff like that, and ask them if they recycle trees.
When you say take it to Metro, so this is a big hole in the ground somewhere, or it's like a dump, or it's a thing. What is that?
You've never been to the dump.
I've never been to me either. I'm sorry. I hate to disappoint you in every way.
You go to North Portland, there's this – it's fascinating. It smells horrible, but it's fascinating. There's this huge facility where you take garbage. It's where all the garbage goes. It's where the garbage trucks go. And you go there and you pay by like however much your stuff weighs. So they weigh your car going in and then they weigh when you're leaving and you pay. And these guys like motion you into this enormous building. And the building is full of garbage. And then they back you up to a pile. They tell you which pile to back up to. And you offload your garbage. And it's fascinating because really you get to look around and you are surrounded by just enormous piles of all of the other crap people have thrown away. And it really is fascinating. Of course, it smells really terrible. And you're indoors, but there are seagulls, which is really disturbing. But it's
no, guys. She's taken.
It's really fascinating. It's something you should experience at least once. It's really interesting.
Okay, here's why. By snarking, notwithstanding, here's why that is fascinating. And now I think, regardless of what other solutions might have been available, this is the avenue that I'm taking. This is my play, because I think I've mentioned this when I was growing up, that there was like a, I think like an unsanctioned landfill. I mean, it literally was just like a huge ravine. And it was behind the Knights of Columbus Hall in my hometown. And there was a huge, they might have owned the property for all I know, but I don't think so. I think it was like just one of those tracts of land that like the government hadn't said like dibs or whatever. And like nobody could put a flag on it. And so it was a huge like little canyon. And people, the whole time I lived in Kennewick, people would just like, if there was something you didn't want to take to a regular sanctioned dump, because somebody might ask, like, what's in that barrel? You know, are those feet? And it's like you didn't want to, you know, F with that. So you would just go, and literally you would just back your truck up to it and go, and just dump it in. And you would occasionally look down there, and of course the seagulls, but then you'd see people sort of picking around. And as a kid, I do remember thinking, like, this place is fascinating. It reminds me, have you ever read... I believe Shampoo Planet. Mm-mm. Might be Generation X. It's one of the early Douglas Copeland novels. But he, or it's Girlfriend in a Coma. I think it's Girlfriend in a Coma. Anyway, but there's some point where in one of the books where a guy actually, I think it's Girlfriend in a Coma, because it takes place in the future, but I think a guy actually sells the service of sort of spelunking down into landfills from an earlier time, where it's like there's these sort of huge glass tubes that have been stuck down like giant straws into landfills and then like emptied out. And then you can put on like a little suit and sort of go down in these sort of bendy straws, and you can go around in tunnels that basically just go down into a landfill. And you can go down like 70 years and see what people were throwing away in 1980. So it is sort of a fascinating thing. The seagulls inside is especially creepy. Are there people sorting it and stuff?
Yeah, and they have imagine a building that is one story. It's all open inside, but it's a good like say five stories high.
Right.
And it has these big open doors and things, which is where the seagulls come in and go. And yeah, there's guys, their whole job is just to like, you know, use moving equipment and shoves big piles of stuff around. And then there's like, you know, an area you take toxic things that need to be dumped. And there's an area for electronics. And then there's bins to put papers and stuff like that. And which is especially fascinating because you can like peek over the top and sometimes fish out like really cool old like Time magazines and things like that. But yeah, just to see. And then basically all day it's just people driving in and unloading anything that they just basically needed to get rid of, a lot of.
Weird.
They needed to get rid of it. And so, yeah, it's fast. It really is fascinating. But, yeah, it does smell horrible.
Okay. No, I'm all over that place. Okay, that's – I know what I'm doing, if not this afternoon, then tomorrow. All right. Well, let's do one more. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Let's see. We got the clue number two. They're doing your EH vending contest for this week. So we got that. We got your Taser Watch. Top five posthumous albums. Of all time, we'll get to that. Top five posthumous releases. This is Don Taylor.
Well, Alicia and Bill Elam of Springdale, Ohio, thought they were doing a very smart and frugal thing by going to GameStop and buying a used Nintendo DS system for their six-year-old son. Alicia said, he's 6 years old, and I can't see buying a new game system for a six-year-old. They drop things. Things happen. So their son, it was the Nintendo DSi, he powered up the handheld game system. And instead of playing like Super Mario or whatever, the first thing that he espied was a pornographic photo apparently taken by the DSi's previous owner with the unit's built-in camera.
Oh, unfortunate.
She said there were two pictures already on it. One was a man's face. One was of his private parts. Ali said she went back to the store where GameStop's manager was very understanding and swapped it for a brand new unit at no additional charge.
This is, you know, you got to wonder, this is like, again, the thing we were talking about with the guy who was getting his grope on the subway. And then, you know, and the woman's like, everybody's going to see what you're a groper. And she was taking a photograph of him. We were speculating that the internet has given rise to a whole new kind of exhibitionism where you can just be like, and now everybody will see my penis. And it makes you wonder if, I'm not saying that's the case here, but maybe it is. Like, it's a guy, because it is sort of like a delayed reaction. It's like he's a gorilla. A flasher, you know, like he sort of strikes when you're not expecting it, because why would you expect that? And the answer is you probably wouldn't. And so there's probably, it's like in most of these things now, you see they're most of them are fake, but there was that whole little slice of time where it's like people would be like, I don't know, they'd be like putting something on eBay, and it would be, you know, like a picture of a tea kettle. But it's like they'd be taking the photograph while they were nude, and if you looked at the tea kettle, you'd just see a reflection of their junk, and you could like, wait a minute, hold on a second. And so the internet and just technology have given us all kinds of ways, because I think that's the thing that people used to do with people used to do that with cameras. You'd hear about some guy who got, you know, he would take some horrible series of photographs and then send them to like the Walgreens to get developed because he liked the idea of like somebody there going, you know, park, seagull, picnic bench, penis, and you know, just being sort of, you know, and it was, and that must be kind of what goes on with some of these guys.
Maybe or just it slips through. Like I said, apparently GameStop said that, you know, they do check and clean out used equipment, and they spend a lot of time and a lot of money doing that. But apparently this one slipped through. Although, you know, again, I don't understand why people take pictures of their penises.
Well,
at all.
Well, but again, you know,
I mean, I'm not against it. Don't get me wrong. It's like, more power to you. I don't understand it.
It's a, you don't understand. It's not that you don't understand why people, let me clarify your own thoughts for you here. It's not that you don't understand why people take pictures of their penis. You don't understand why somebody would want to see pictures of the penis.
No, and I also don't understand why someone would want to share pictures of their penis with someone else. I mean, I guess intellectually I can kind of justify it and sort of figure it out, but it doesn't. But on a fundamental level, I really don't understand it.
Well, I'm just – because if one operates under the never mind. I'm just spending way too much time talking about some other guy taking a picture of his penis.
We were talking, though, about – because I always worry that I'm going to have to get – I don't have, like, porn or anything like that on my laptop, but I worry that at some point something might fail and I'll have to take it in and it'll be like just embarrassing crap that I have on my computer. And I did have last night I had one of those moments that everyone gets with their computer now and then where it just decided it wasn't gonna work, and it just sort of powered down, the screen went blank, and the little power button was just flashing on and off. But I couldn't power.
And you couldn't, it wouldn't turn on, it wouldn't do anything?
Right, it wouldn't do anything. It wouldn't power up, it wouldn't power all the rest of the way down, it wouldn't do anything. Fortunately, because I have my iPhone, I was able to still get on the internet and figure out what to do, and found that this is a problem sometimes. I've never had this problem with my computer, and it's almost 6 years old, but sometimes, particularly the HP laptops, there'll be this problem. And they said, you know, you need to perform a hard restart.
Right.
And so, which I've never done before, but it said, do this. So it's like, turned it over, took out the battery, pushed the button, ran all the juice out of it, put the thing in, and it started back up and it was working. And I swear to God, I was like you with the fuses in your car. The idea that I didn't have to take it to a guy.
And you fixed it yourself.
I didn't have to go in with my shame and my ignorance and go, it's not working and I don't know why, I'm an idiot. And I was able to just do it. And I was like, I'm brilliant.
Are you like this in that you do? It's not that you don't remember how you got along without this, because you probably, by definition, there was no need for this. It's that It's that you are ever so grateful at times like that that you have more than one way to get on the internet, because it's like the one allows you to fix the other.
Right.
Because I've done that thing before where it's like I, you know, and I gotta say, you know, that it's, you know, whatever one thinks of Apple Computer and their products, you know, Macs are pretty stable. They don't, you know, they don't crash a lot or lock up or whatever. But I've had one or two times where it's like I would put some new piece of software on or something would happen. It would just be like, I'm not going to do it. You know, I'm not going to do anything. As a matter of fact, ball, and it would just spin. And you, after a while, you're just like, crap. And then I think the one time this happened was like last year or something. I turned it off and I waited and I tried it, and it would start back up. And then it gave me some weird, you know, it wasn't like an error message. It would just get to a certain point and then it would just kind of stop. And it's like it wouldn't finish booting up. And again, it's that thing of like suddenly like. It's like suddenly your life is imploding on you. You're just like, I can't do anything now. I don't even know how to live. And then you're wondering like, oh my God, do I still have AppleCare? Is it going to cost me if I get – or you know, if I take this in, like are they going to take it away from me because they have to like send it off to like Apple land to be fixed? And then what am I going to do in the 4 days that I won't have access to a computer like at any moment that I might need one? And you're just – your whole thing – it's like it just becomes – and then the thoughts just start stacking up.
Yeah, and I did. And I started to get kind of panicky like that. I really did, because I was just going, it's not doing – I can't make it do – I don't – and then I was like, okay, before I completely freak out and panic, I will use my phone to access the internet, and I will – obviously, must have happened to other people somewhere. What did other people do?
And that is such a great, satisfying, relieving moment when you look up and you go – like you'll go to Google and you'll go like – error message, you know, 562 or whatever, and suddenly you get the what to do if you get error message 562. Oh, thank God. Because it's like just seeing that, you realize, as you said, like somebody else has gone through it and they probably fixed it. And so, you know, I had some I had some as a matter of fact, unsurprisingly, the issue that I had when this thing just would not boot up all the way, it was because, you know, for reasons that I didn't want to bother to go into, I have a Mac, but I also run Windows in the background. And I would say 90% of the time that I've had to just really stop and put like elbow grease into fixing it, it's because the Windows part of my Mac machine just is effing up on me. But I went on, I was like, what to do if you have this problem? And I was like, thank Christ almighty. And I did. And it's like, and then it worked. It worked, and it just worked flawlessly. And I just, and then it just, and you, and then it's like the earth begins turning once again, and the sun once again comes out from behind the clouds. But don't also at those moments, don't you start to get that sense that like, it really is like some addiction that we've got to technology. I mean, almost like in a clinical way, and maybe not even not physically, except in so much that it's in your brain. And it is like a chemical response of like panic when you feel like your computer isn't going to work or you can't get online or something. You're like, oh my God, my iPhone's dead. My Android won't turn on. What am I going to do? And then you really do start to like almost have some sort of like an anxiety attack about it. So it is like a physical response. It reminds me a little bit of like, you know, you like we've all seen the movie or the thing where it's like the guy, like the junkie loses the stash and he's tearing the house apart, you know, it's got to, or house, you know, the Vicodin's got to be here somewhere. And he's just, you know, looking around on the floor for like anything that even is even shaped like a Vicodin, you know.
And now we do that when we can't find like, you know, the power cord to charge our phone.
It's like when I was driving to Kennewick a couple weeks ago, and this is before I managed to fix the fuse in my car, like the masculine specimen that I am. And I had my iPhone with me, and it was that thing. And it really was like junkie-like behavior, by the way, because listener Rick had given us the power cords. You know, he'd give me the power cord and for Christmas for the for iPhones. And
the car charger.
Yeah, the car charger. But it wasn't working yet because the charger itself in my car wasn't fixed yet. The fuse hadn't been replaced. So I'm driving to Kennewick. And it's like I'm listening to, you know, like an audio book or something, and then I'm driving along, and then, you know, I stop at a rest station and check my email. But then it's like I realize that the power bar was like half gone. It's like I'm not even halfway to Kennewick yet. And I thought – and it's like I've made that trip in my life 10 jillion times. Most of them, by the way – in fact, I think all but one of them without an iPhone. Many of them before I had any phone of any kind at all. If I had in fact just been kidnapped, and just taken for like nobody, there would have been no way to tell anybody. I had no communications device whatsoever. So it's not like it's not possible. But I get like a third of the way, the dowels or something or cascade locks. And it's like I realize the phone is like half dead. And so what do I start doing? I turn it off. And then I just start using it sporadically. Like about every 20 or 30 miles, I'll stop at a rest station, turn it on, and check my email with the brightness turned all the way down. so I can just make it last. And that's when it's like, that's when it's like you've got the pill bottle and you're just like boiling the cotton in top or something, you know, just, you know, you're like rinsing the bottle out with like liquid, thinking, well, maybe there's some ground up Medicaid, maybe there's some Vicodin to the bottom in powder form. You're just trying to make the iPhone battery last, just, you know, even if it's not as satisfying to just use the iPhone a little bit at a time, because otherwise it means going without, and that's a hell you can't even contemplate.
Also, in addition to the car chargers, listener Rick, also, he gave me a iPhone case that has a bottle cap
that's
on
right.
the back. And that was quite the hit at poker night on Saturday night.
I saw you pull that out of your like your purse, your pocket, whatever. You're like, would anybody like their beer open?
And everyone was going, this is awesome. You have a beer opener on your iPhone.
Which when you think about it, I mean, I'm not trying to knock the gift. It was really handy. But when you think about it, it's not like it should impress anyone.
No, but everyone thought it was so cool.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I mean, there's really nothing. It really is just like, it's like if you
it's
just
a bottle opener on the back of a phone case.
It's like, yeah, it's like if you just had a tiny corkscrew like on your keychain or something. Like it's not, you know, it shouldn't really, but everybody's like, oh my God. And Scott Daly.
Everyone's like, I would open my beer now.
Actually, around a mouthful of beer goes, that's the best thing I've ever seen. So, I mean, it really was, it was a huge hit. Well, for the love of God, we should take a break here. We'll come back. We'll do clue number two for this week's EH Vending Contest, Taser Watch, and the top five posthumous albums. Be listening for that. Won't you please? You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. Oh, we got to recap House, too. Let's not forget about that. Speaking of Vicodin. So then we come back. It's the Rick Emerson Show. Stay right there.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network. Emerson News Network.
Just so cute and neat and sweet, and I think she's starting to like me.
Listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. Somebody says, this is, by the way, this is about the Norm Wooster singers earlier. OMG, that is the creepiest song I have ever heard. Nightmares, Here I Come. Loving You Lots and Lots sounds like a mechanical teddy bear with a huge knife knocking on your bedroom window and following you down a never-ending hallway. Okay. It is a little unnerving, I think. Maybe if you were to hear it in the wrong context, you know, or late at night if you were not expecting it. It might be a little creepy.
I assume by I love you like a cuddly bear, they mean, you know, like a little stuffed teddy bear.
Yes.
Because when I think of a bear, they're not very cuddly, really.
Richard Hatch.
They're angry.
Oh. No. Two different ways there.
Yeah.
Hey, let me just tell you about, let's see, where the... Was that Richard Hatch?
No, that was my bear sound.
Oh, okay. Really? I don't think they're...
I don't know how to do a bear noise. I was making claws, though.
I don't know. What's the sound of your intestines going down something's throat? Let's see. See if I can... hold on. Let me just turn this down. So this is what he was talking about here. We were just playing this moments ago. Let's see if I can...
You are the winter, fall, and spring. You are the sun that summertime brings. You are the stars in the nighttime sky.
I guess I can see there's a little bit of a weird factor to this. Just because it sounds so otherworldly. It's got all that reverb on it. It's got that sort of Jordan Ayers sound.
This was used in That Thing You Do, wasn't it?
This is the opening. This is the opening credit song, yeah. This is... Which... And I love that movie. I gotta tell you, I love that movie like nobody's business. I love that movie like I love few films. And I actually saw it, I think, four times back when we used to see movies multiple times in the theaters or, like, at all. I saw this movie four times in the theater, and it's like, I remember at one point I took this trick to see this. It's like, I'd already seen it once, I think. I had already seen it once, I think, and I told this, there's some girl, and I was like, and I think we'd gone out. I'm like, I'm going to go see this movie, The Thing You Do. You got to go with me. And I think she wanted to see it because it had Tom Hanks or whatever. And, you know, and he was like America's sweetheart or something. And I think we got like 20 minutes or 25 minutes into the movie. And she just goes, she goes, I don't like this. And I was just like, okay. You know, and I went back to watching the film because I no longer cared if I was rude to her, if she saw me. It like doesn't matter. And I know that guys are all motivated by like, is she going to hump me later? But it's like, you know what? There's certain kinds of... I'm not saying if you like this movie, you're, or if you don't like this movie, you're a bad person or something. But I mean, it was just, I think at that point, I don't know, maybe it was just the mood I was in, or maybe it was that I'd just seen the movie, you know, like the previous week and I'd loved it. And I was like, you know, we're just never going to get along, and I don't think I can tolerate being around you long enough to even have relations with you.
Yeah, I have no problem saying that, if you don't like this movie, then fine, that's your prerogative, but I will never sleep with you.
Yeah, that was my thing. I was like, you know, you are so fundamentally irritating and just unpleasant to me now in every way, even sitting there in the theater saying nothing further, that I don't think I could ever have a carnal knowledge of you. That is not, by the way, that is a separate incident from which I believe this happened earlier that same year. This is a separate incident from a girl that I did have, as they used to say, designs on. I had some specific plans in mind for later in the evening, all of which completely fell through. By the way, when we went to see the Bridges of Madison County, and I was just sobbing like a child at the end. Just sitting there weeping, just crying like a woman at the end. Except when I said crying like a woman, she wasn't, of course. Mm. She was just sitting there just dry-eyed, I think kind of checking her nails out every now and again and sort of like inspecting the bottom of her shoe. And meanwhile, she's so sad, you know, while she's sitting in the cab looking at Clint Eastwood in the rain. And I'm just... And at one, this is, by the way, just the final thing, because then I have to end my own humiliation here. It just becomes like an, it then becomes my own never-ending hallway where I'm being chased by a bear of my own shame. This is, by the way, the moment when you know you're not going to get sex at the end of the evening. When you're in the theater, you're watching Bridges of Madison County, you, me, sitting there, first of all, just blubbering like a retard at the movie. And then she does that. She does that thing of just like reaching her hand over and just kind of patting my hand, just sort of not a hug, not a consoling embrace, not a grip or a holding of the hand, interlacing the fingers, just sort of patting my hand.
A pitiful there.
Like you would do to a stranger on an airplane who was having some sort of flight terror, but whom you didn't really want to know anything about or talk to like ever again. You go, it'll be okay, creepy guy. And that was it. So there you go. The end. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. One more observation about the Norm Wooster singers here.
Yes.
So I went through this phase, and I actually don't do this much anymore, but I've gotten much more zen about my, not just my music taste, but the music taste of other people. And I think we've talked about this before, that I've gotten to the point where I'm secure enough of my own knowledge, you know, I know what I enjoy in terms of music, and I know, you know, what I typically do not enjoy, and whatever. And I don't feel like the need to kind of, and really, I don't. And if you think I do, you were fortunate not to have known me like 20 years ago. But I don't really feel the need to like force my music taste on everybody. I mean, I definitely have opinions and thought, but it's like if somebody disagrees, I just kind of go like, you know, whatever. That's your boggle, not mine. But I used to be really, really like afflicted with what Nick Hornby called music rage, where I was just like really angrily into bands sometimes, like shoving them down the throats of other people like some sort of castor oil I felt they had to take. And that would occasionally manifest itself in the most passive, juvenile, retarded ways. There was this deli in or not even a deli, it was like a diner in Salt Lake called, I don't know, some things, and I, you know, the choke and slurp. And so I would go there occasionally with some of the guys that I worked with. And on more than one occasion, they had the soundtrack to That Thing You Do in the jukebox of the restaurant. And on more than one occasion, I would, when we were getting ready to leave, I would just go up and I would put like $10 into the jukebox and just put this song in over and over and over and over again. You know, like enough to, and I would calculate it out to where it was going to be like 4.5 hours of just. And then I would hit play just as we were about ready to leave. I have no idea why I would do that. I mean, what really?
No.
What am I proving by playing this song at people? I mean, all it's proving is that I'm going to end up like in a Quantico folder at some point. That's really it. There's nothing. Not that Tom Hanks would ever authorize this, but doesn't this seem like the kind of song that should end up in some horrible serial killing movie? Like,
oh yes,
you know, as a guy's just like firing up a bandsaw in the background. All right. Anyway, yes, this is the opening credits as Guy Patterson is running his fingers along the top of the washing machine as though they were little feet. We should do something else. Let's do this at the news desk, ladies and gentlemen. It is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Let's do our Taser Watch.
Awesome. Here's your Taser Watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. You got me running, going out of my mind.
I didn't do it wrong.
You got me thinking that I'm wasting my time.
Don't take me, bro.
I'll tell you once more before I get off the floor.
Don't take me, bro.
Here's your Taser Watch for Tuesday.
Electric stun gun manufacturer Taser International has brought out yet another new weapon, which could perhaps eclipse even its existing technologies in terms of controversy and media brouhaha.
Excellent.
The new Taser X3W wildlife model is intended to take down, comparatively harmlessly, such adversaries as charging bears or moose. The wildlife electronic control device prototype, according to Rick Smith, CEO and co-founder of Taser International, is designed to deliver a neuromuscular incapacitation pulse from 35 feet and can fire 3 shots with each load. Just as our Taser technology is a safer and more effective option to stop dangerous individuals, the Taser Wildlife ECD is an extension of Taser's technology to save animal lives. It's designed to incapacitate larger animals more effectively and safer than current animal control tools.
And see, here's the great thing about this is that you know that with a company like Taser, it's just like they must – it can't be a recent thing. They must at the outset just say like, Bob, I've invented something. What is it? Well, it's a thing that puts 9 billion volts of electricity into your body. Well, isn't that dangerous? Well, yes. And then fast forward to like years later when they must – the litigation and the regulation they must have anticipated is coming to fruition, and then they roll out Plan B, which is the thing where you're tasing moose or whatever. They must – at the outset, they must – what are we going to do when they make it illegal? Look at this, and then it's
and
that.
It'll have a big label on the side that says, do not shoot this at people.
Right, exactly.
So they can't blame us.
This is like – I mean, that's really what the Four Loko guys never really – they never really planned that out. You know, they never thought, like, what will we do when this product is eventually banned, as it almost certainly will be? Taser, they must have had like a second or third or fourth act already planned. By the way, would you like to reveal that that earlier, in fact, once today and I think once yesterday, you used the word mooses to describe multiple incidents of – but now is it – did we ever find out if it actually
is? No, we never found out, but I believe that the plural of moose
it sounds really
is
wrong.
Moose.
Yeah.
I don't believe it's mooses.
No, I don't think it sounds it sounds hella wrong.
But for some reason, that's just what comes out of my mouth.
Okay. When
it will cost $2,000. Provided that both darts hit the target separated by a reasonable distance, a crippling 20,000 volt pulsed current can be passed through the body. This will generally cause a human to collapse immediately. And it now emerges, according to experiments by an Alaska Department of Fish and Game operative, that tasing will also incapacitate both brown bears and moose.
See, this is the thing where on the one hand, I'm glad that I root for the success of the Taser company, the Taser International. They seem like a fine outfit. I got to get a T-shirt from them and just sort of like wear it around because I like what they do and they've given us so much. But it's like the things don't seem to work that well on people. You know, and you get some guy charged, he's just a guy. He's just a guy, maybe with a screwdriver or something in his hand. Maybe he's done a little meth. A bear is a bear.
Yeah.
And if it's not working well on a guy who weighs 170 pounds, seems like, you know, the idea that you're going to protect yourself on the Appalachian Trail, that's no.
Well, and the Alaska Department Fish and Game official said, you know, who tested it, said, sure, it works, that would work. On the other hand, though, Fish and Game wildlife technician Larry Lewis spoke to the Daily News last summer. This was a prototype at the time. They were talking about it. And he said, I just shudder when people buy a piece of equipment and all of a sudden think they don't have to do anything proactive in bear country.
Yes.
It's a false sense of security that gets people into trouble and leads them to make decisions they wouldn't otherwise make.
It is not unlike the guy who gets an SUV and then feels he can stop 6 inches before the red light, in a heavy snowstorm. Because, hey, I'm in an SUV and I got me some of them stud tires. And then he just slams on the brakes right as he gets, you know, up to the light. And then he just skids through and just takes out a family of 12. So, yeah. By the way, you are right. It is not mooses.
No, I have a couple of – everybody has – we're talking about weird things that you say that you can't not say differently. One of the other things I – for some reason I say mooses, and I haven't ever been able to break myself of saying mooses.
Right.
Another one is when I was a child, I was a huge Disney fanatic. And I loved The Sword and the Stone. And I had just learned to read and had just learned to sound things out. Mm-hmm. So I kept saying sword. And my mother, you know, really did her best to break me of that, explaining that the W was silent,
right.
The subject was silent. Then, of course, I fell in love with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And I kept saying dwarf.
Yeah.
And to this day, I will catch myself occasionally saying either sword or dwarf.
Because you had the right rule for the wrong word.
Right.
So, yeah, you obviated the W from, yeah, but then you took it and put it in a different word altogether.
And there's nothing more humiliating than being an adult and saying sword.
Well, you know, and it, you know who underscores that is Touche Turtle, because Touche Turtle says sword. And there's probably an entire generation of kids that had to be broken of that habit because they would always hear it. But then that's the thing. It's like then you are doing what you think is correct, and then it just results in you mangling another word. Also, you know, the idea that the idea that in America that we still, it's like we got to do one or the other. We either got to figure out a different system for like spelling everything, or we got to quit teaching kids phonetics, because phonetics just served to F you later on if you were trying to speak like American English. You know what I mean? Like that is not, phonetics are not going to help you at all. It's like the same reason. I remember when I was a kid, I had to say, what was the word I said out loud? I said like rendezvous, but I think twice in class I said like rendezvous or something, you know, and then somebody finally corrected me at some point. But I was in a school where they were teaching us to speak by phonetics, which completely screws you.
Well, that's the thing, yeah. Every time you want to, you have someone to say, sound it out.
Yeah.
Well, that's not always right,
no.
Is it?
I'm going to make a call on the pajon. I guess, smack. On the subject of mooses and the whatever and the thing, we were talking, I think it was between two shows today, I was sending an email or something, or maybe it was yesterday, and I was talking about that whole her and me thing. Mm-hmm. And you and I basically, it turns out that we're on the same, we fall down on that the same way. We come down on the same side of the equation, which is that even if it's wrong, we will say the her and I just because it sounds more correct. Mm-hmm. Do you do the thing, do you do the thing of saying octopuses?
Yeah. Yeah.
See, and I can't bring myself to do it even though I know it's right. That's a thing where it's like I still say octopi, and I just, even though I know that it's wrong, and it like, and I feel like I just am selling out a little bit more and more every time I say octopi.
Fortunately, I don't really talk about them that often, so it doesn't really
but
come
see,
up.
But see, the thing is, once you start to fixate on it, it seems like it comes up in every conversation. It's like once a day I feel like I'm in a conversation where I'm bored of having to refer to a plural of octopus. And then I have that momentary crossroads in my head where I don't want to say it, you know.
Is it detritus or detritus?
I say detritus.
I do too, and I'm not. And then I'll say it, and then I realize I'm not entirely sure that it's correct.
No, I'm almost positive that it's pronounced detritus. Here's the thing about that: unlike octopi, octopuses, where I think one is demonstrably correct, which is octopuses, and the other one is not. The thing about detritus and detritus is you can always, here's the thing, you can always cover your tracks just by saying it's a British American thing. No, that totally, you can always do that. If when it, because it's a, well, there's multiplicity. Mm-hmm. But I read some of the other day, you know, apparently in here in these United States in our fading republic, you know how you're supposed to pronounce a variant in that? You're supposed to say multiplicative.
No, that's
what I'm saying.
Horrible.
It's multiplicative. Right? A, because it sounds more fun. I mean, yeah. That's just more enjoyable to say. It sounds like some sort of a snack. Or like a it sounds like a tiny little candy filled with little sharp edges of sugar. You know, like try a bag of multiplicative. Multiplicative just sounds dumb. Multiplicative sounds like you haven't quite met, like you're on training wheels verbally.
You know, we have just grammar nitpicked our way out of a top five.
Why? I don't have to be anywhere.
Oh, that's right. Greg and Sarah were here this morning.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. For some reason, I forgot they were here this morning.
No, never mind. We'll go to it in just a second because it's like, you know, we got places to go. Not really. I am glad that I arrived when I did because I was running a little late this morning, but I arrived just in time to see them rounding a corner. So I did actually see them leaving this morning. And so I walked in going, okay, you know, it's at the very least, like if we run behind, we're going to be able to do anything. So no. We'll do that here in just a second. That was a taser watch, right?
It was.
All right. So there you go. Ba 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 multiplicative. There's your taser watch for Tuesday.
You got me running, going out of my mind.
I can do it, bro.
You got me thinking that I'm wasting my time.
Don't chase me, bro.
It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us today. By the way, then it becomes a thing where you have sort of, I don't even know if they're British, but there's sort of alternate pronunciations of certain things that you use either because they are sort of amusingly mannered or formal or they were referenced in some work of literature, like winged monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just becomes your de facto pronunciation. Like I am not capable, just as like I'm not capable of saying robot, it's robot. I say winged. Also, I find myself saying advertisement, not advertisement. And I came very, very, very close to making schedule part of my, but it was like, that was where I just had to draw the line. Because then it's like, then you just look like a Nancy.
I was, I learned so much of my speech from reading, because I was an only child and I spent a lot of time reading. And I learned a lot of things from both reading novels and reading comic books and stuff. And I've actually had people explain to me sometimes over the years that things I will say out loud are not necessarily things you're supposed to actually say out loud. Like, for example, sheesh. Apparently, you're not supposed to actually just say sheesh.
It's supposed to be written only?
It's a sound. It's apparently that is the spelling of somebody going shh,
right,
or something. Yeah.
Well, but I say that occasionally.
I actually say sheesh.
Well, I guess it's sort of like it's not really like saying lol, but I mean, maybe it's just sort of maybe it's just one of those things that is meant to exist. It's like a Don Martin thing. It's like an onomatopoetic,
yeah,
you know, thing. It's a representation. Let me ask you this. Speaking of sheesh, doesn't sheesh sound like it would be some sort of like an Arabian food, of like a sauce of some kind,
yeah,
or like a thing you could scoop up with pita?
Mm,
you know, like pita with extra sheesh, please. I always feel like there's some sort of a wormhole opening the universe when I order something with extra naan. Like you get your chicken tikka masala, extra naan, please, and then it just like for a minute, like all the logic things in my head lock up. Wait, sheesh. Hold on a second. Let me just... how do you spell this? If this is another sheesh thing, like if somebody... It's an exclamation. It's an interjection. How do you spell pshaw?
That's the one I was trying to think of. I actually have been known to say pshaw.
Right.
It's like sheesh. And I've been...
I say it too.
I've been corrected by people saying that that's not an actual word. That is just a spelling. P-S-H-A-W. That is just actually a spelled restaurant. Somebody's just going...
But that doesn't make any sense because that doesn't sound anything like P-S-H-A-W
no,
at
but
all.
That's one of those things where I have...
You spell it with an apostrophe?
No.
See, I do. I do like a P apostrophe S-H-A-W. So are you
but
saying
I've been
that...
known to say, you know, someone will say something and I'll say, oh, pshaw. And so, and actually I've had a couple of people say, no.
See, I've never...
You're not supposed to say that.
I've never been corrected. I've never had the situation where somebody told me that it was like not a thing you actually said out loud. Now, is it... So it's not... Well, first of all, the idiot is not an actual word. It's silly. If you can spell it and if it's an acknowledged construction... if it's an acknowledged construction of letters, it's a word. That's what we call words. That's how they're defined.
And I guess it is actually a word.
If you're stringing together letters in a way that everybody understands, that is the definition of a word, I think.
It is actually a word. It means an expression of disbelief or skepticism.
But is it – where are you looking it up?
Well, that's just in internetslang.com.
Okay, well.
But, you know, if that will count.
I don't want to nitpick. I wonder, because here's my thing is, I wonder if there is an accepted spelling, and is it like.
No, it's in the.
What is the etymology?
It's in the online British Encyclopedia, P-S-H-A-W. There is no.
But there is a W. Glossary.
Yeah.
What's the derivation of it? Is it like a country of origin, or is it like Yiddish or something?
I don't know. It's a. Apparently they go all the way back to Sir Walter Scott saying it, though, to express disgust or contemptuous disapprobation, as by the explanation pshaw.
I've got here, let's see, Merriam-Webster says it's an intransitive verb. It is dated or humorous, an expression of contempt or impatience. Origin, it is a natural exclamation first recorded in England in the late 17th century. So there you go. All right. So it is, in fact, a word. And by the way, it does at no point here does it note that it is a written word only or a thing that is not meant to be said aloud.
People who gave me a hard time.
I'll end this by saying that I have a friend of mine who says two things out loud and then he'll catch himself because his brain isn't as highly trained as yours. Because when it comes to the sword dwarf thing, you'll probably catch yourself. Like if I were to hear you saying the word dwarf, would I hear a little micro pause before you as you figured out how to say it correctly?
I think it depends on context. If I'm talking about just, you know, dwarves, I will usually, if I'm just thinking of dwarf, but for somebody, if it's Snow White and the Seven.
You have to stop for a fraction of a moment.
I will have to stop for a moment to make sure I don't say dwarf.
He doesn't do that. And so as a result, like his tongue gets ahead of his thoughts. And this is what he will actually say out loud, Penelope. for Penelope, and he will mispronounce chaos as chose.
Chose.
Which apparently is, he'd never heard it spoken aloud till he was like 12. And that was how he heard it in his head. And I'm like, what did you think it was? And he's like, I don't know. I thought it was this cool thing. There was lots of. And so it is just chose. And he's tried to beat that out of him. But it's like, you know, he can't. He's tried to, you know, to expunge that from his own pronunciation. But it's just, there's no getting around it. He just can't. There's nothing. We should take this opportunity to give you clue number two for the E.H. Vending Contest. Don't forget E.H. Vending, one of the fine business partners of the Rick Emerson radio program. You can contact them at ehvending.com. That is ehvending.com. Don, please now to construct a sentence about E.H.
Okay.
What are you doing over there, Don?
Eating.
Do you just wait for any moment where I'm going to be distracted for just like a second? Or if I begin a long sentence or if I just inhale deeply, implying that I have a great torrent of words about to come out, you're just like, eat break. Okay.
Sometimes it appears you're going to be busy for a while.
Okay. What are we eating?
Tortilla with peanut butter.
Okay. Anywho, I'll get back to you tomorrow on that. I'll just say that ehvending.com is the website for EH Vending. You can also contact them via phone if you'd like. That is Josh.
Swallowed now.
At 360-816-1853 or James at 503-897-8204. Please then now to construct for me a sentence about EH Vending, their business or service in which you use the word pshaw.
Me have no need for a vending machine. Pshaw! Of course I do.
Excellent. Fantastic. Well done. So there you go. You can contact Josh at 360-816-1853 or James at 503-897-8204. And again, ehvending.com. They provide all style of vending services and machines from the traditional kind. You got your soda, you got your snacks, your chips, to the office coffee supply where they bring in everything. It's not just the coffee. It's the coffee, the filter, the basket, the whole damn thing. They will customize to your needs. And that's not just about what you're stocking. It's not just about the kind of snacks you're offering your customers, your employees, or whatever. It's also about your budget. If you only got the one outlet, or you only got one store, one business, or you're downsizing, or you're just cutting costs a little bit because of the economy, they're going to find a way to make it work for you. You're not going to get it's not going to turn you away because you're too small of a business, which does happen occasionally. Apparently, that is a common lament in the business world, that the vending guy says, "Well, no, if you don't have more than 17 locations, I'm not, they don't want to know from you," as my grandmother would say.
And also, if you're a small business, you may not think you have any actual need for a vending machine. And I've worked in small offices where there really weren't very many employees, like, maybe about like 8 or 10 employees. But the fact that we had a Coke machine in the back, back like warehouse area was a godsend on those days when you don't want to actually have to leave the premises to go get a beverage.
And also, Don or I might stop in at some point at your business. And I mean, as I think the past will demonstrate, if there aren't snacks available, like at every moment.
Yeah.
This is sort of like an EpiPen. You just have to have it with you all the time because it's like you think you're not going to need it. And then suddenly, somebody demands a Mounds bar and there isn't one. And it becomes all kinds of unpleasant. I will say, I'm holding it now in my hand. This is one of the gift bags from EH Vending. This is substantial.
That is a substantial sack full of snacks.
I mean, it is really, it's heavy. There's a lot of stuff in here. Ooh. This looks fantastic.
That's not for you.
I know. And can I just tell you how tempted I am? I won't steal anything, but it really is tempting.
We already went through our giant box of snacks.
How shameful is that? The thing is, we almost shouldn't say that because then that they're just going to try to fatten us up again. Or even worse, that they wouldn't. And then we'll just sit here sort of looking over it,
Remember when we had snacks?
Or it's like the gift bags that we're going to be giving away to the audience. It'll be just like a whole, where we're like trying to pick the center forward to eat because he's weak anyway.
Yeah, and sadly, then we'll just start slowly picking away at the gift baskets.
And somebody's going to get it, and there's going to be crumbs on the bottom.
Yeah, there's going to be like one bag of chips. Nothing else, and just tears.
We are giving away one of these every week, and so the deal is we give you one clue each day, and then once Friday's clue is given out, so that'll be Friday the, 26th, 27th, 28th, Friday the 28th of January. Once we've given Friday's clue, if you are the first person to correctly identify the snack which we are describing, and you describe it correctly via snack at rickemerson.com. Again, that's Friday. You will win one of these gift bags from EH Vending, filled with all kinds of things that you can put in the machine that they put in your business. So again, we are going to do one clue every day. If you guess early, we're going to disregard it. You got to wait until Friday's clue is given out. And you email your guess once Friday's clue is given out to snack at rickemerson.com. That is snack at rickemerson.com. Today's clue. It comes in five flavors. Comes in five flavors. Now, I should say, actually, that Cheryl has created these clues. Now, beneath this... Don, come here for a second. Come look at this email. Because beneath this, she's written this in the form of like a Q and an A. The Q, it says... comes in five flavors, and then below it, it lists the five flavors, but it says A next to that. Do you think I'm supposed to read those?
Also, 1, 2, 3, 4. Actually, I'm seeing six flavors.
No, that's one right there.
Yeah. That's fine.
Do you think I'm supposed to read these?
No.
All right, so I'm probably not supposed to read them. All right. There you go. All right. So we are.
I apparently can't count flavors. So
she says no. Do not announce the flavors. All right.
Good thing we have Cheryl.
So that is today's clue. Comes in five flavors. That is Tuesday's clue. Once Friday's clue has been given, if you're the first person to correctly identify the snack, again you get this huge bag of stuff here. It's from ehvending.com. ehvending.com. A proud business partner of this, the Rick Emerson Radio Program.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Apparently, one of our listeners who won a couple weeks ago, who won one of the gift bags, is going to be stopping by today.
Oh.
May, in fact, be waiting in the kitchen under the misguided idea that we would be done at 3:30. So we'll get the top five done here, and then we will bring an end to all of this nonsense. Don't forget to join us tomorrow when I believe our guest will be Mr. Aaron Mesh. So that's from Willamette Week. So that's coming up tomorrow, I think. All right. All right. I'm sorry. I'm just reading a thing here. Is the listener in the kitchen now? Is he sort of in the break room now at this very moment? I guess I could just open the door, or have Dawn open the door. Really? Would he like to come in and claim this? All right. And then, just by sheer coincidence, or something, approaching an evil level of genius, it is in fact listener Rick of the aforementioned iPhone/bottle opener/car charger/whatever.
Yes, I don't know if you heard earlier, but if you were listening, but I took my my iBottle opener to a poker game at Scott Daly's house on Saturday, and it was quite the hit.
It was quite a hit.
Awesome.
All right, so yeah, this is listener Rick. In case anybody sort of blocked this out, you are the one who actually correctly identified the sound of corn nuts being chewed.
Absolutely.
Just because you sat next to your sister-in-law or somebody that was sort of chewing on those for like a decade.
Yeah, my sister-in-law Dee Dee. I played her the podcast this weekend, actually. She's a little bit intoxicated already, but she laughed. She was tearing. It was awesome.
So because she never knew that, you know, something that you viewed as an irritation and an annoyance was, in fact, going to pay off
yes.
at some point in the future. So,
exactly.
I mean, you've turned those snacking lemons into prize-winning lemonade.
No one would think.
Awesome. All right. So I have here a large bag of stuff from EH Vending. So
excellent.
Congratulations, my friend.
Thank you very much.
So what's in there, anyway?
Let's go.
I can independently verify, by the way, that I was at the poker game at Scott Daly's house, and that iPhone case/bottle opener, that really was, I mean, it was the hit. She was the belle of the ball with that thing.
Yeah, we got Fritos and chips. We got several flavors of
the
Fritos.
Including the plain potato chips, which apparently there is a large market for those. I mean, the bag is just
endless.
It goes on. It's
that.
A heavy bag full of things. So.
And Diet Dr. Pepper, you know, I like that. Okay.
It is a smattering from across the snack spectrum, my friend.
Candy and...
Candy, just a ton of chips, I tell you that one. chips.
Is that an exciting new jalapeno flavor of something?
Corn nuts.
Yeah,
of course.
An exciting new jalapeno Cheetos.
Excellent. Jalapeno. See, but see now you can give back to your sister-in-law.
I told her I would.
Yeah. Now it's not a one. You and here's the thing. The corn nuts thing in that bag, totally a coincidence, but you can tell her that you planned it that way, that you know that we just you asked us to put a little something in there for her.
The corn nut gods.
Yeah, just slide a little, you know, just let her wet her beak a little bit, as they say.
Sure, sure.
Awesome.
All right.
Congratulations, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
Lovely to see you.
All right.
Enjoy your carbo loading.
Hey, guys, ever need anything for a phone, just give me a holler.
Thank you. Excellent. There you go. That is listener Rick, ladies and gentlemen, folk. In the Dropbox, I put today's top five.
And I indeed have it right
here. Here's your top five
four,
for Tuesday.
3, 2, 1, fire.
Counting is wonderful. Counting is marvelous. Counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness, counting is ecstasy. I love to count, don't you?
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. This is your top five for Tuesday. These are the... Are you squinting with disapproval?
No, not at all.
I've made a whole sort of hobby over here of trying to read your facial expressions.
I am such a cipher.
Well, no, I'm just saying.
I'm like a sphinx.
Well, as evidenced by the fact that just now I wondered if you were sort of. It looked like you were narrowing your eyes in some sort of judgment. But see, I was wrong.
No,
only right about 40% of the time with that. I misread your facial expressions almost on a daily basis.
I need a new pair of reading glasses. That could probably be it. I'm squinting at things and it looks like I'm disapproving. And it's just that I'm getting older and I need a pair of glasses.
So it's disapproval and myopia just sort of, they all kind of blend together. All right. These are your top five songs for Tuesday. We picked a track from each record here. These are the top five albums. So these are not necessarily singles. The top five albums released posthumously. And, you know, in some cases, you know, they were ready to be released already. In some cases, they were you know, rush released. In some cases, in at least one case, I think the album was on a shelf and was probably never going to come out until a guy cacked it. And then suddenly the record company said, my God, there's money in the bank with this. So these are the top five posthumous releases of all time. Don Taylor.
The honorable mention is Sublime. Sublime.
You have no idea how much it pains me.
The eponymous Sublime.
It fills me with agony.
I have to admit, I was a little bit surprised to see that, but
Well, because this is one of those lists where I'm trying to be a little objective about it. I'm trying not to filter everything through my own prism. I really dislike this band. Now, to be fair, it really does astound me, by the way, that Paul McCartney, it didn't just sue his ass into oblivion for this, because it is so clearly Lady Madonna.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the...
Oh, yeah.
It is, you know, I mean, to the note, I mean... But, you know, I don't really care for Sublime, but I will say that my loathing of this guy and this band has more to do with the fact that I did live in Southern California for a period of time, and then I moved here right as everybody here seemed to be listening to this, and it was like I couldn't get away from it. There was like, I don't know, it seemed like about 18 months where everywhere you went, it was like this one record being played by this, you know, it was this band, this one album, which came out, I think, 2 months after Brad, overdosed on Smack. And it was just playing everywhere. And so I went from never knowing who they were. And let's be honest, it's not like it's a form of music that I'm especially fond of anyway. This sort of like, I don't know, this sort of like weird, like, I don't even know. It's not reggae. It's a sort of like, I don't know, what is this? It's like a strange sort of like weird acoustic-y kind of slowed down dance hall.
It's rock
or something.
It's smug hipster rock.
I mean, that's, you know, it's not even that. It's like the guy who sits on... You lived in Southern California. It's the guy who sits on the wall at the beach with a dog on the end of a piece of twine and asks you if you've got a quarter. And then, if you mind, if he cleans his works there. You know, and you're just kind of going, okay. And he smells like dirt and ass. That's what I think of when I look at this band. So in any event. But again, I have to say, the album was a huge hit. had three singles off of it. The fact that it had three singles indicates that it's not just like, it's not like the Jeff Buckley thing where the guy's just dead and so somehow he becomes great. They obviously did have some radio-friendly singles and they knew how to write a good hook and, you know, whatever. But this was sitting on the shelf of the record company and it was never going to come out. I think it had actually been put on permanent hiatus until the guy overdosed and then the record company put it out and it did become, it became a certifiable hit, and I guess a certifiable classic, depending on who you are and what kind of music you're into. And I can't front on that, as the kids say. So these are the top five posthumous albums of all time. Don Taylor?
Sorry, I just listened to the song, and every time I hear the song, I'm thinking, gee, what a surprise, he overdosed. Five, Otis Redding, Dock of the Bay.
And I almost made this the honorable mention because Dock of the Bay, because the album Dock of the Bay was not entirely new material. That was a thing that did, I believe it got put together by the record company to complete the album because he wasn't done with the whole thing. He had recorded this, and he had recorded a few other songs, but I think he had like two-thirds of an album done when he died, and I think the record company was like, even for a dead guy, this is bilking the public if we don't finish this a little bit. Do you have anything laying around? And so they found like some live stuff and some outtakes. They used the rest of those as sort of like that binding agent in the Taco Bell meat. But this was to be the lead single off this entire record as he was recording. And then of course, here's an embarrassing way to die. Plane ran out of gas. It wasn't even like there was a mechanical failure or it was shot down by aliens. It just ran out of gas. As though there isn't what Jen Lane used to call a gasometer on there that tells you, like, you know, that maybe you want to stop and top it off a little bit. But, I mean, come on. How great is Otis Redding?
Otis Redding was wonderful.
And I know that this song gets overplayed and the song, you know, everybody hears this a jillion times, but I mean, so what? Wasting time. It's got that great, like, kind of greasy horn section.
Like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do. So I guess I'll remain the same.
It's a great song.
I also like it because it's sort of the opposite of like a feel-good inspirational song. It's a song about just like, you know, giving up.
Right.
And I admire that. That really plays to my strengths a lot, I think. Just like, you know, this is it.
You know what it is? It's sort of a beautiful shrug. You know, it's not like he's, you know, like it's a lament or he has the worst life on earth. It's just sort of like, well, things kind of suck right now, so I'm just going to sit for a while if it's all right with you. Just sort of a, you know, like I'll pick up the thread later. Yeah, for now, I'm just going to kind of lean here for a while. And it's got, you know, the whole Steve Cropper guitar line and the Booker T and the MGs in the background. I mean, really, just one of the great house bands of all time. Great song. And, I mean, it's kind of a great posthumous single, too. Because even though it is a little bit downer lyric-wise, it has a great sort of carefree sort of feel to it. And it is almost the perfect song to go out with, you know, as a dead rock star. I mean, in some ways, it doesn't get much better than that. These are the top five posthumous releases of all time, Don Taylor.
Number four, Mother Love Bone, Apple.
I wanted to put Chloe Dancer, Crown of Thorns. To use that as the representative single, except that Chloe Dancer, Crown of Thorns, as everybody sort of knows it, as it exists on the singles soundtrack, and as it exists on the re-release of the Apple album, it is not actually that way on the posthumous album itself. So Andrew Wood from Mother Love Bone dies, he ODs, the record Apple comes out. On Apple, Chloe Dancer and Crown of Thorns are not connected. They are two separate songs. It wasn't until the record company reissued Apple a few years later, post-singles, whose soundtrack contained that song, that the more widely known version of that song became mainstream.
I did not know that.
If you bought Apple when it first came out, you didn't actually hear that version. It was one of those things that I don't know if Cameron Crowe made that decision, if it was an alternate version the band had toyed with, if it was the record company. But when the single soundtrack came out, those two songs had been joined. And then on every reissue of this album since then, that's the case. But I wanted to be sort of period accurate here by not using it. This was the closest thing they ever had to a hit single. This is Stardog Champion. I love this album. I really do. That's where my And this is one of the only songs in the world that has a children's chorus that doesn't suck. I mean, you can count on less than one hand the number of great rock songs in which a children's chorus is singing. Can't Always Get What You Want, Another Brick in the Wall Part 2, this. I got nothing.
No.
Here's the great thing about this song, this album, this band, and this guy, is that while everybody else in Seattle was just, I don't know, shuffling around wearing a bunch of gray tweed or whatever and just sort of, you know, I don't know, just staring at their shoes and pretending they were poor, Andrew Wood, like, wanted none of that. If you look at the guy, I mean, he looked like exactly what he was, which is a guy who grew up worshiping glam and classic rock and Zeppelin, and who himself looked like a David Lee Roth clone for a lot of his life. And who wrote these really great, sometimes dirgy, but sometimes really upbeat, sometimes really, like, rollicking rock songs. And who had no... He was a guy that and was not at all ashamed of the fact that he wanted to be a huge rock star in a big-ass rock band. And then, of course, you know, and it is sort of the irony that he died, and then his death resulted in some of the definitive works of that era, which were trended in a totally different direction. It's interesting, too, have you listened to this album, you can hear the sort of nascent Pearl Jam sound, where it's like these big ocean waves made of guitar chords that are just sloshing back and forth.
Yeah, I always forget how much earlier this band was than, like, Pearl Jam and grunge. That's
89, I think.
Yeah, because the sound is so similar. So I always tend to lump them in with, you know, that entire oeuvre.
Yeah, this album came out a couple months after Andrew Wood died, and I think 2.5 years after, or 2.5 years before, rather, Nevermind. I'm a star dog, baby. No idea what the song is about. No idea.
He's a star dog.
I guess. I think it's just one of those rock things where it's like it just sounded cool. And if he just sings it in the right way, and if you kind of purse your lips, you just sort of seem like a badass.
Like being a Jeepster for your love.
I'm sorry?
Like being a Jeepster for your love. Yeah, Mark Bolan.
Yeah. I don't really have the T-Rex knowledge that some... You know what else is like that? The low spark of high-heeled boys. No idea what that means. You really can't picture Nirvana using a children's chorus, can you? Yeah, this guy was cut from a different cloth. I bought this album because Dave Kendall, host of, I guess it was called 120 Minutes at that point on MTV, with his, like, you know, with his sort of, like, Smithian hair and his leather jacket, said that, he said, this is the phrase that he used. It's so horrible, but this is the phrase he actually used. I don't think anybody really says this, but he said, Zeppelin heads will want to pick up Apple, the new full-length from Mother Love Bone. Zeppelin heads.
Zeppelin heads.
And I was a huge fan of Zeppelin, and so I bought this because he was... All I heard about these guys... The same thing I heard about Jane's Addiction for some reason. It's like they keep wanting to make people like the new Beatles or the new Springsteen. About like Jane's Addiction and this, they just kept saying it sounded exactly like Led Zeppelin, which I don't hear and have never heard.
No.
I ended up liking it quite a lot, but it was sold to me as like being like a sort of a Zeppelin clone type band. These are the top 5 posthumous releases. Don Taylor.
Number 3, Johnny Cash. Now, do we call this American 5?
Yeah.
100
yeah.
Highways?
So this came out, I think, the month that he died.
Can run on for a long time.
This song
run
just
on
kills me.
For a long time. Run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down.
I mean, come on.
Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down.
I mean, I just get chills, and not because he's dead. It's just, you know,
well,
even
my goodness gracious,
if Johnny Cash were alive and living on the shores of Maui right now, this song would still give me chills because it's like he just has that something. He has the gravitas.
Yeah.
And we've talked about this before, but by all rights, it shouldn't work anymore. We should be done with Johnny Cash. We should be burned out and over Johnny Cash. And it just, there's just something there. It's just inexhaustible. It is an inexhaustible, inexpendable supply of cool.
Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut him down.
And you got to give it up to Rick Rubin, too, for knowing exactly how the song should sound.
You can run on for a long time. Run on for a long time.
This is in True Grit, isn't it?
For a long time.
Or is it in the trailer only? The trailer for True Grit uses this.
Yeah, I think it might be. I don't remember, honestly.
The trailer, the longer version of the True Grit trailer, I think, is cut to this. And by the end of the trailer, they're cutting, the scenes are cut to this. And so with each downbeat, it cuts to a different shot. And then it just it goes to black on the final cut you down, and it just says True Grit.
Run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider.
You know your nail polish matches the color of your thumb drive?
Well, you're right, it does. Look at that.
Is it intentional?
No.
God's gonna cut you down.
Never has there been a conversation that clashed more with the music playing underneath. All right, these are the top five posthumous releases of all time.
Number two, Joy Division, Isolation.
Here's the thing about this song and this album being on this list and this band. This is one of those things where I feel like somebody who is colorblind having to put together a museum exhibit a little bit, because there's things that I understand intellectually and I know because I've read them and I've heard people discuss them and I know sort of the history. But I really know, like, dick about Joy Division. I just know that, like, what's his name? Ian Curtis. He, like, recorded two records, this being the final one, and then I think he hung himself or something, or shot himself. He somethinged himself, and he's dead. But I do know that the influence and the shadow of this band, I mean, is massive. I mean, I know that, like, the Joy Division really just echoes through a certain kind of music, a certain sort of new wave kind of, synth pop is the wrong way to put it, but it's sort of British new wave. I know that the number of times I have heard this band and this album referenced by people, I mean, it's just I've lost track, and it's like every review you read of it, you know, it's like Nick Drake stuff where they just talk about, you know, they talk about how his death added to it, but that it was already a fantastically, wonderfully bleak record beforehand, but that the death was just sort of a perfect kind of capper.
Yeah, I just have to take your word for it, because I also don't know much about Joy Division, and I never liked
them. See, that surprises me. I would have pegged you as a Joy Division fan.
I never liked stuff that was heavy with synthesizers very much. I remember I went through a period where I listened to Kraftwerk because I was so heavily into Bowie, and Bowie loved Kraftwerk. So I listened to Kraftwerk, and I liked them as sort of a curiosity. But when it came down to, you know, if you look at that period of music, I was listening to punk. I was listening to ska. I didn't really ever like the disco-y new wave synth pop stuff at all.
Joy Division is sort of like, Joy Division is to is.
It sounds really cold to me.
And it does to me too, which is why I don't really listen to a lot of it. I mean, it's like there's some, which is why I never listened to Kraftwerk. And I was talking to Gustav about this. I saw him on, I guess, New Year's Eve or whatever. I was somewhere and he was there, and we were talking about, and you know, he's like Mr. Teutonic, synth music. And we were talking about Kraftwerk, and he goes, "So, Rick, why weren't you ever into Kraftwerk?" And I just said that it sounded very cold. It's that I don't listen to Kraftwerk or Joy Division for the same reason that I don't listen to prog rock. I don't listen to Yes, because it just sounds very clinical and it sounds very unfeeling. But I know that there are people that's what they're after. They're after a certain sort of distance or a certain sort of intellectualism in their music. I do know that if you talk to Joy Division is to new wave fans and bands as Al Green is to soul fans and artists, and that you just say Joy Division and, like, everybody in the room goes, "Oh, you don't even," and then they just go on about that second record. And again, that he was a famously bleak and morose guy already. You know, yeah. He was like at Morrissey levels, and then it's like, here's my second record before I die. You know, and he was like, he was shuffling off the mortal coil as he handed the acetate master to the, you know, there you go, the A&R guy, you know, with like his last breath or something. So in any event, and so that is they have a long shadow in the world of music. These are the top five posthumous albums of all time. Don Taylor, what might number one be?
Oh, that would be Nirvana, Unplugged in New York.
Here's how great this record is. This record is so great that it is, I think this record single-handedly, I won't say that it reversed my opinion of or my thoughts about Nirvana, but I will say that this, I revised my opinion of Nirvana drastically based on this record. Because I was...
It had that effect on me. I mean, I pretty much turned up my nose at Nirvana for a long time. And, this really, I think, sold Cobain to me as a songwriter.
Yeah. And it's just, it's such a great, I mean, the arrangements, I mean, it's, you know, people say Unplugged and they think it's just him and a guitar, but it was him and I think two other guitarists, and they had Chris Novoselic doing like an Unplugged bass, and they had there's cello at certain points. I think there's a viola that comes out on stage at one moment, and they have backup, you know, so the Kirkwood brothers from the Meat Puppets are there for a while, and the arrangements are really careful and delicate and precise. The thing about Nirvana is it's always seemed to me, I now don't know whether this is a thing Kurt Cobain said or whether I said this at one point and I'm confusing it, but Smells Like Teen Spirit to me always seemed like, it just seemed like they caught him in the studio like in just a certain mood on a certain day with that song. And he recorded it, but then he recorded a bunch of other stuff as well. But, like, that's the thing everybody seized on. And Smells Like Teen Spirit just seems so non-representative of what Nirvana did.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't nearly as punk as people wanted to give them credit for, but they were also not... But they wrote a lot of stuff that wasn't nearly so straight ahead and formulaic as Smells Like Teen Spirit, which was a really formulaic record in some ways. Great song, but, I mean, it follows a quiet, loud sort of, you know, light and shade thing that rock has been doing, like, forever. And so that always seemed like an aberration to me. And when you listen to this album, it could be an aberration because it's unplugged and everything else they did obviously isn't. But hearing this, it seems like this is how Nirvana should have been. Like, it seems like he would have been, and according to, you know, like his suicide note or whatever, maybe he would have been happier if he had pursued a different kind of music that did not immediately put him in the position of having to replicate something that maybe was not representative of what he did. Because this sounds so much more natural to me. It sounds like this is what was supposed to come out of this guy. Yeah, when I heard this record, and again, it wasn't because he was dead, because I didn't like him when he was alive, and I didn't like him anymore when he died, so, you know, whatever. But when I heard this, I actually had to stop and say, okay, you know, I'm never going to be a huge Nirvana fan, but I mean, this did turn the tide for them in my head a little bit. And plus, let's give it up for one of the great... prolonged scream sections, like in all of recent rock here. I bet the A&R guys were doing jumping jacks in the hallway on the first listen to this record after he died. Because it's like he did their job for them, yeah. You know? I mean, they didn't have to do anything to this. I mean, you know, they said, oh God, he's dead. What are we going to put out? I don't know. They recorded this thing in New York for the Unplugged session. Let's listen to it. And that they end the record with this. I mean... And he had enough of an ear for arrangement that he knew that they couldn't end on that. They had to do this where they go through the progression again with just a cello and the... It's like they must have just... I bet they could just feel the money in their hands as they heard this. I mean, it sounds like some sort of an elegy, you know. And who knows? You know, maybe it was. He obviously was not a happy guy for a long time. So, I mean, and I don't mean to sound so cynical about it. I mean, it's a great record. It's a really great piece of music. But it's like it. But you can't. It is just such a perfect record to come out after a guy dies. And it almost, you do wonder if like he either thought about that or planned it that way. And if not, like the incredible luck of it musically and then also like commercially, the fact that, I mean, they had this, you know, it's like the whole thing of like, what's his name, Biggie Smalls, who had that, you know, that Life After Death, which is the double album that came, which I almost put on the list, by the way, very close. I came very close to putting Life After Death on the list, which featured, it had that song like You're Nobody Until Somebody Kills You. And it was, you know, and that's the thing where it's like you just, it's just so perfect that you almost can't believe that it just sort of timed out that way. So
it's just it's a very depressing list, though, because there's somebody like Otis Redding and like Kurt Cobain, where there should have been so much more that we could have had from them.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a,
Well, and then it's like, you know, and I don't want to I am like the least qualified person to lecture anybody about anything about, you know, whatever in terms of how to live your life or, you know, moral behavior or anything. But you do, in a sense. I understand that, you know, the depression and mental illness and drug addiction are very, very real things, and that occasionally, as you know, as I think Kurt Loder put it, he's like, you know, he said, you know, sometimes it's just, you know, the idea of living another day the way you are in your life is like so bad that really anything, even death, seems like a plausible, you know, seems like a plausible step up. So I do get that that's real, but then at the same time, I had almost put together this list of the top five worst posthumous albums, which I didn't. And one of the top five worst posthumous albums would have been this thing called this album called Made in Heaven, which is where the rest of the guys in Queen, by the way, setting a precedent for what would become an ongoing series of behaviors with them, just decided to flog the corpse of Freddie Mercury by taking just some crap that he hadn't finished. And like going and like finish and writing instrumental stuff around it and writing music to accompany it and using just outtakes and demos of his vocals and fashioning together like a final Queen record. And you know, and it was just, and it just, it, it's called Made in Heaven. And it's just so cloying.
Yeah.
So cloying. And it's just a terrible record. Not because it, just because it's, and the reason that Made in Heaven, and I swear to God, will everybody go home. The reason that Made in Heaven by Queen is such a bad record is not because, like, if you listen to it, you go, these are terrible songs. Because they're not, like, terrible songs. You can tell it's a little, you know, that Mercury wasn't, like, in the best of voice or whatever. But it's because, and this ties into the thing about Otis Redding and Kurt Cobain and those guys kind of going away, you know, too soon. You know, you got Freddie Mercury, who has AIDS, knows it, knows he's dying, because at that point there's no way to stop it or slow it. And it's like, and the guy's like singing like up till the end. I mean, he's like to very nearly, I get chills thinking about it, just to nearly the final day, where when he found out he has AIDS and they're like, look, there's no cure, you're going to be dead in 6 months. And he actually told the guys in Queen, he's like, I'm going to be dead in 6 months. He's like, we are going to spend every moment we can until the studio, you know, in the studio recording until the day that I can't sing anymore. And you hear that the show must go on, which he did in a single take. That is a single live raw take, and they layer harmonies and everything afterward. But Freddie Mercury's lead vocal on the show must go on was done in one take, and they said that he was actually so frail at that point. And I don't think this is just apocryphal. I mean, there's some sort of video that it was shot, and they were kind of recording the moments toward the end of his life as they happened. You can see shots of him recording the song. So Brian May tells the best story about Freddie Mercury, where they get ready to record The Show Must Go On, which is such a mind blowing song. Anyway, I mean, in terms of, you know, in terms of just, you know, when you, you know, you look at it through the prism of what we know now and whatever, but they're in there, and Freddie, you know, and it's like the show must go on. The song was written with the knowledge that he was not long for this world, and they go into the studio, and I mean, if you've seen those videos of him from near the end of his life, he's painfully thin and just looks terrible, 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 and he goes into the studio, and he has a bottle of vodka, and he steps into the microphone, he has his headphones on. And where he just picked up this bottle of vodka and he just tipped it back and took this really, really long pull on the vodka bottle and slammed it down on the counter. And he just said, roll it. And then they hit the playback on the instrumental track. And then he just does this amazing take, and like one take all the way through of The Show Must Go On. And, you know, and that was one of the last days he was ever in the studio. I mean, it's just like the best thing, which is what makes it, which is what pisses you off then so much when you just, you know, when Kurt Cobain spends his days whining about being rich and then shoots himself.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like Freddie Mercury is there, like basically being wheeled in a casket and singing, you know, because he just didn't want to go, you know, and
This is like the worst ending for a show ever.
Yeah, I know. I was going to ask if there was something we could play to like give you a little pickup here at the end. You got nothing?
Do you have anything from the? Do you have something from the new Social Distortion album?
I do,
because I've been enjoying that and a little something there.
I do. In fact, I will. Let's see. Here's what we'll do. Get this. I'll get this all queued up. So we should say. I believe we have not yet confirmed this, but I do believe it is true. We're going to be talking to Mr. Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week tomorrow. He will be in the studio with us and so forth. And then let's see. Thursday, I believe Anna Griffin is in this Thursday. You know, I can never tell because it's like an every other week thing with her, and I can never really tell. It all kind of blends together. So we'll be talking to Anna Griffin, I believe, this Friday, and then or this Thursday, and then Friday. Mr. Big Jim Willig will be in the. Studio with another installment of Humor Me. That is Comedy 101. That is all coming up later on in the week. Let's see. We want to thank our guests, including Mr. Eric D. Snyder from ericdsnyder.com and also film.com and Cinematical, and also Movie BS with Baron Snyder. You can hear him Fridays, 11 to noon, as at Cascadia.fm. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milk Packing District here in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. After a brief interlude, we'll have an encore of today's Legion of News, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program at the news desk. Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. Thank you for listening. It is Tuesday, January 25th, 2011, and that is The Frequency, Kenneth. I'll see you tomorrow. Be safe. Bye now.
Was a moonlight mishap? You lost your party hat. Seems your lifestyle ain't so worthwhile after all. A heavy-hearted taxi ride and a walk on the wild side. Did you call an angel let you down? Gonna lay low and play it straight. It's time to rejuvenate. Gonna kickstart your heart to come around. Give me the sweet lowdown. You better get out the way. It's history made the hard way. From a hero to zero once again. Ain't no time for vanity or this insanity. You're maladjusted and now you're busted once again. Give me the sweet lowdown.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Abandoned places, I guess we know.